Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
It may be hard to believe, but in Massachusetts, public school discipline involves suspending students as young as 5 years old. Last year, kindergartners and pre-K students were suspended 603 times, 68 in one Dorchester school alone, leaving families and many in the education field wondering why. WBUR's Peter Ballinon Rosen reports.
Dolores Michel's son, Deshaun, was suspended from school before he could read, write, or tie his shoes.
Oh, the first time was incredible. That was early last year. They called me and they tell me that my son had done this and done that. You need to come and pick him up right away. And I'm saying, what did he do?
When Michel got to the school in Dorchester, she found out. After Deshaun got off the bus, he pushed to the front of a line to get in his class. He wanted to be first.
The teacher didn't want him to cut in front of the other student, so the teacher have him wait outside.
And the five-year-old Deshaun did not like that. His mom says he banged on the classroom door and ran into other classrooms. When a teacher stepped into a doorway to block him, Deshaun slammed that door. The teacher's hand got caught.
They did an x-ray. They say it's a hairline fracture on the finger.
And Deshaun's punishment? Suspension from kindergarten.
I understand he should not have swung the door, but he's a kid. He doesn't know that was going to hurt the teacher like that.
The principal initially wanted to suspend him for 3 days for assault on staff. After Michel spoke with a lawyer, the punishment was reduced to 1 day. Either way, Michel says Deshaun didn't completely process what the suspension meant.
He did not understand why he did not have to go to school. He wanted to be in school. So how fair is that? That's stopping him from learning what he could have learned.
There's a handful of factors that put Deshaun at higher risk for suspension. First, he's mildly autistic. Last year, students with disabilities were suspended at more than twice the overall rate. 1 in 16 were sent home. Second, he's black. Black students are suspended almost 4 times as often as their white classmates.
Black babies cost less.
If the child fails, don't do well, is there a provision that says, now let's assist them? Is there money set aside for let's empower that school? No, they close it. And then now your child is bussed out, right? Got to wake up a half an hour earlier than what have you, you know? You got to prepare, even get up even early yourself to prepare up a decent breakfast. You know, to allow your child to have something to fuel their knowledge. And then how long does it take that child to return home? You know what I mean? Now is a school day for my son 12, 14 hours. How the hell do you do homework when you're tired?
You often hear parents talk about the toll that testing takes on their children's self-esteem. But when testing is at the very center of what a school does, the score that a student gets becomes more than a score. To hear parents like Will and Robin tell it, in their kids' minds, these scores become the mark of what they're worth.
They ingrain the information that comes back from those tests. And those tests are a little hash mark on a really colorful piece of paper that says whether you are below basic, basic, proficient, and advanced. The children that are basic and below basic, they believe that they're failures. And as much as their parents can tell them not, and their teachers can say that they don't treat them that way. The children believe that they are not worthy. They're not smart enough.
context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Tuesday, April 26th, 2016. So I have been told. We had Dr. Umar Abdullah Johnson on yesterday, ironically also from Pennsylvania, and he spent a good bit of time and energy answering questions and offering recommendations for things that black parents can and should be doing to protect your children if you unfortunately have them in the public school system, or if you're looking for different alternatives, things that you can do to try to make sure that your child has the best chance to develop and evolve academically. And the racism rampant throughout the educational system in this part of the world, worldwide really, but if we're talking about the U.S. specifically, that is going to be there to stifle your black child. I can only encourage, highly encourage, if we have black parents, black educators, black folks, even if you're not a parent, but you have black children that you're concerned about, and you want any suggestions or have questions about things that you can do that would aid any black child that you're concerned about, aid their academic development, definitely chime in. This is not a program that we want to have people just spectating and sitting back, listening. Dial in, particularly black parents. Dial in if you have questions, problems, thoughts that you want to get. Dial in the number 641-715-3640, and I will definitely make sure that we get as many calls in as we can from people who have questions that they would like to ask. The program for today, one of our listeners, black parent, she saw an article. It was republished in the Washington Post. It was talking about how a growing number of black parents are turning to homeschooling as a result of racism. Because there's so many different things that are in place that make it so difficult for black students to excel within the public school system. She thought it would be great if we could get the author on the program to talk more about the subject matter and get some of her thoughts on things that black parents can and should be doing. Our guest, in addition to writing that article that was republished in the Washington Post, and it is linked in the description for the program for folks who would like to check it out, she is an associate professor and director of the graduate programs of the Department of Africa American Studies at Temple University. Before arriving at Temple, she taught at the University of Texas and Pennsylvania State University. In addition to that, she is the managing editor of the Journal of Black Studies. She also has content published there. Real privilege to have her on the program to discuss this subject matter with us this evening. Joining us live from Pennsylvania, our guest, Dr. Amma Mazama. Dr. Mazama, you're with us?
Yes, good evening.
Good evening.
And thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing some of your Tuesday evening. I know you have a lot of other things that you could be doing with your time and energy. Just anything that you think would be important for listeners. This might be their first time hearing about you. Anything you think would be important for listeners to know about you and the work that you do?
Well, yeah, one thing is that I am a homeschooling mother myself, and so this is how I got to be interested in that topic. And certainly I'm very much committed to really justice for black people, you know, wherever we find ourselves. So, and I'm very much outraged by the treatment of our people, especially our children in the school system and in the society at large, but in the school system in particular. So, yeah, I'm coming from that particular place, and I'm speaking from that particular place.
Outstanding. For folks who haven't seen you, just making sure you're a black female, is that correct?
Of course.
Of course, right on.
I'm black, and I'm an African woman.
Outstanding. This program, The Cows, Context of White Supremacy, I have unfortunately concluded that the problem, as you stated, the war that is being waged against black children and black people in general worldwide, that is the system of racism, white supremacy. I use those two terms as synonyms, and I use the same definition for both terms. The definition I use is as follows: a global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you think such a system exists? Do you think that's an accurate definition?
Absolutely. If the system exists, it is very much in place. It is very much functioning nonstop, 24 hours a day. And I think that there are major institutions that Europeans have developed to sustain and carry out their program of domination of the people of color. And within those institutions, the school is a major, major weapon against us. You know, Marcus Garvey used to say that there was a race war going on, and I really believe that's the case. And I think that when our children go to school, oftentimes they become casualties of war. They are damaged to the point where it is difficult, if not impossible, to repair them. The problem is that it's very insidious, or sometimes it's brutal, but it's very difficult to come out of schooling in a white supremacy society undamaged. And the problem is that many times we, the parents, don't realize what's being done to our children until it's too late.
Wow. Brilliant analysis. I agree 1,000% everything that you just laid out. Just background information, you were not born in the United States, is that correct?
No, I was not born in the United States. I'm from the Caribbean. I grew up in a country called Guadeloupe, which very few people have heard of. It's in the middle of the Caribbean. My country's been occupied and colonized by the French, since 1635. But interestingly enough, you know, although I did not grow up here, the issues that our children face, regardless of location, are pretty much the same, precisely because of this system of white domination, which is a global system. I just spoke tonight with a sister from France, and she was just telling me what the black children are going through in France right now. It's unbelievable. Children who are suspended, you know, when they are in pre-K, expelled from school. Pre-K, black children, simply because they ask the wrong questions, or the parents just ask questions about the curriculum. You know, why is it that our children, there's nothing black about the curriculum, that our children will not learn anything about? That is enough in France for a black child to be suspended.
Global white domination.
It really is a global system, yes.
Wow. What, just growing up in Guadeloupe, was this an issue for you growing up there in the Caribbean?
Absolutely. We learned absolutely nothing but ourselves. My very first experience when I was in kindergarten was with a teacher. She was a black woman, but she didn't think of herself as black. You know, she was a mulattress, I guess. She had light skin, blue eyes, straight hair. And she had decided that the blacker, darker you were, the farther away you should sit from her. So the front row, right next to her desk, she had two or three little white girls who were in the class. And then again, you know, the darkest children had to sit way in the back, and she pretty much ignored them. So, you know, this is internalized racism here, but we know where it comes from. Again, it comes from this white global system of domination, which entails making us feel inadequate, making us feel inferior, and using the school, again, as a place where they can spread those ideas about African or black inferiority and white superiority. And, of course, you know, the curriculum, the program, of course, did not include any mention of black people at all. You know, so we grow up thinking that we are people that we are not, that we even live in a place where we actually don't live. You know, our eyes are really focused on Europe because that's all we learn about.
Wow. You went on to continue your education in France, is that correct?
So when I graduated from high school, I went to France to study, and I spent 9 years there. And when I got my PhD in linguistics, then, you know, I came to the United States. I'll say honestly that it was really a shock. because when I was studying in France, I had taken a course on the United States, and I was told by the professor that in the books that we had to read that, you know, things had been settled, you know, as far as black people were concerned, as far as racism was concerned, with, you know, by the civil rights movement, that, you know, with Martin Luther King and the struggle for the end of discrimination, that things were okay. And so, of course, you know, when I got here, it didn't take me long to realize that it really was not okay at all, and that other than South Africa, I could not think of any country where black people were more oppressed on a constant basis, you know, as the United States. And, of course, I did not accept it. You know, I could not accept it. So it's been a struggle.
Wow.
And then having children, then, you know, of course, you know, you want to protect your children from this white racism. You know, see it every day. You know, see it every day. And especially if you have black males, you know, and I have two sons. So, you know, they're worried about them and decided to, you know, I was not going to surrender them to the school system. You see, I use that term deliberately, because for me it's really surrendering to your enemies, you know, taking to them what you have that is most precious, your children, and giving them up and telling those teachers, here is my son, here's my daughter, and do whatever you please with them. And I couldn't do that because I knew exactly what the plan was. And I couldn't go along with it.
Wow.
The beautiful thing is that more and more black people are not going along with the plan, and more black people are keeping their children home and educating them at home in order to protect them from white racism.
Before I kind of get to some of the things that you lay out in the article and some suggestions, and then, as I said, get some calls as well, just your study of linguistics, one of the things that we really try to emphasize on this program is the significance, the importance of words and the way that we articulate, verbalize our ideas about white supremacy, what strategies, techniques for neutralizing that system, and even just paying attention to the way that words are used to strengthen, uphold, maintain, and refine this global system of white domination. Just can you kind of share some of the things that you observed, some of your research from linguistics and what you saw in terms of how racism, white supremacy, just the way that words are used helps hold that structure in place?
Oh, absolutely. Because, I mean, language is extremely important, you know, in terms that it really structures our thinking, you know, it gives us words, it gives us concepts, right, that basically frame our reality. So, you know, when you think, for example, about the ways or the words that are used to refer to black people, just think about the word black alone in the English language. It has a word that has extremely negative connotations. I often have my students do that exercise. You know, just look for, you know, synonym finder, look for a synonym for the word black. And they're always like, wow, yes, you know. So, and then you think about the ways also Africa is referred to, you know, as being primitive, savage, backward, underdeveloped, and so on and so forth. So all these words are being used to really impose a particular construction of Africa, of black people on us and on other people as well, who look at us and automatically associate us with negative things. So we have to be extremely careful. And again, I'll go back to Marcus Garvey, who is someone whom I respect a great deal. And he understood that very clearly, you know, and he said we really have to be very, very careful. In particular, symbolism associated with the word black and with the word white, you know, that white racism really uses that language as a tool of oppression and mental domination.
Absolutely. Mental domination. There are a litany of terms and what have you, in my view, that are used in that manner. I think absolutely, as you pointed out, just the way that the word black is used and everything, the connotations, the denotations that racists have subscribed to that word, as well as the word white. One of the words that I frequently point out on this program, the use of the term fair, using that word mm-hmm. to suggest...
Absolutely.
justice. And then it also is used to suggest whiteness. It's used to suggest beauty. It's used to suggest logic or being reasonable. That's one of the ones that I point out. And also the word minority. And I really try and encourage people not to reference black people as minorities, because just as you said about mental domination, when we're on a planet that is dominated by people who are not white, there are more black people on the planet than white people by far. White people constitute the authentic global minority, being about 10%, maybe less, of the global population. That it's totally inaccurate to use that term to reference black people, non-white people in whole. Just any thoughts on those two concepts, fair, minority?
Oh, I'm so glad you're bringing that up. The word minority, the word non-white, these are words that we really should ban from our vocabulary, you know. I always tell people, you know, why do you call yourself non-white? Because, of course, this is how white people, you know, refer to us, because they use themselves as the standard, right, to define other people in a negative manner. You do not gain anything by defining a cat as a non-dog, you know. So don't refer to black people as non-white or Asian people or whomever, you know, as non-white. It doesn't yield us anywhere. The word minority is absolutely also a big, big problem. And you're absolutely correct. I mean, white people are the absolute minority in the world. They are less than 10% now. I just gave a lecture about 10 days ago about this topic, how, in fact, their numbers are dwindling very quickly. It is estimated that by the year 2070, and probably even better, before that, they would only be 3% of the world's population. So they may be like 8-7% as we speak. So if there is a minority, it's really dumb. It is not the people of color, who, again, it's all part of the bluff. They try to convince us that they are the majority, but they really are not. And even in the United States, very soon, there are already 5 states in the United States where white people are a numerical minority, plus the District of Columbia. In 2020, white children will be an absolute minority in the United States. In 2020, we're talking about 4 years from now. You see? So we have to really be very, very much aware of the use of words, again, to construct a particular reality which is not correct, but is simply used to basically demoralize us and make us believe that the people who are in charge today will always be in charge, whereas the reality is that they have a great deal of problems, demographically speaking. You know, so, you know, I really appreciate your comments about that, because it's very, very important to be aware of the words that we use, the words that are given to us to refer to ourselves. It's very important.
Absolutely. Context of white supremacy. And full disclosure, you also mentioned the term non-white and saying that we shouldn't use that. I think the logic was because it's centering whites and focusing on them. You wouldn't describe a dog as a non-cat and that sort of thing. That logic has been presented to me on the program before, that concept. I use the term non-white for that very reason, just because I bump into so many people, white people and black people, and all people who are not white. I bump into so many people who are unwilling to be honest about the major problem on the planet being the system of racism, white supremacy, white domination. People don't want to talk on that. People don't want to talk about the fact that white power is central on this globe and is causing all of these problems that we're facing, whether it's police brutality, whether it's at the education system, whatever area of people activity that we're talking about, white power is at the center of it. And I really make an effort to make sure that that's what we keep things focused on, that the problem is white people, to keep them at the center of everything. Because I've just seen frequently where people somehow conveniently move that to the side as though we can talk about and solve some of these problems without focusing on racism. Does that make sense?
You can't. You really can't. You know, and the problem is that the reaction of most people is to deny. They are in denial. And the arguments to be in denial. You know, one of them is moving the conversation to, you know, at level of the individual, saying, well, they are not all the same. Here we're talking about, you know, in which people, white people, participate. Certainly, you know, the different degrees, but they participate in it. Simply by virtue of having a white skin, that entails tremendous privileges that they will not give up, you see? And they may not even be fully aware of, but they know. They know very well that this is a system that benefits them. So a few years ago, there was a professor, a white professor, I think his name was Andrew Hacker, who did an experiment with his white students. He told them, imagine that tonight at midnight you become black, that a mistake was made. You were supposed to be born black, but, you know, you were born white, but now the mistake is going to be corrected. So how much money would you like to make up for this, you know, loss of whiteness? And he said they all named like several million dollars. The white students said they wanted several million dollars, and they were asked, why would you want so much money? And they said, because we would have to file many lawsuits as black people to protect ourselves from racial discrimination. You see? So they're very much aware of reality, although they deny it, and we black people, we deny it as well. We deny it as well. We say, you know, it's the thing of the past. Slavery is over, blah, blah, blah. You shouldn't dwell so much on it. Look, we have a black president, and we have, you know, black that. But the reality remains the same. We may not have physical change around our wrists and ankles, granted, but we are still very much dominated people. And again, to go back to the school plays a major role in us being dominated. The school imposes those concepts, imposes that language on us to make us see things and see ourselves in a particular way that will not challenge the status quo of white racial domination. You see? So that's very important for them that we send our children to school. And I like to think of black people who keep their children home as maroons. You know, maroons, enslaved Africans who escaped the plantation and set up communities of their own, which they ruled themselves away from, you know, the white people. And so in many ways, homeschooling is that. You know, that we leave the plantation, and the school is the plantation. The school will turn black people into good little Negroes who will go along, and we leave that, or we never set foot there, and we set up our own communities where we can actually nurture our children become strong black people. Now that's, you know, that's very, very important, you know, very radical in many ways.
Absolutely, absolutely. The Cows, again, our guest, real pleasure to have her on the program, Dr. Emma Mazama. And that you referenced Andrew Hacker. I reference that exact study all the time when people try to suggest or insist that white people are ignorant about racism. Just the fact that they would need that many millions of dollars tells me that they know enough about the power that they have as whites and what that would mean if they were no longer white, if they had to live as a black person, that they know more than enough. They probably know quite a bit more about this than black people do in terms of racism and the global power of being white. Just when you mentioned, I thought that was so important when you talked about the declining numbers, the demographic problem that individuals who classify themselves as white, their numbers dropping and how this relates to what's happening in the classroom, particularly in the United States. When you said by 2020, there will be fewer white children in this area of the world. I wanted to ask the implications, because I think some people kind of seeing that trend, what they think is that under this system of white domination, that whites will just say, you know what? We are not in the business of educating black children. We're not going to fund public schools. If you think public schools are bad now, they're going to be really bad when you see a drop in the number of white students. Like, let's just do away with it completely. Let's just totally eradicate and erode public schools, since we're not really about educating black children anyway. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't think it will happen, because too many of them are making a living off of, you know, teaching in public schools. I mean, if you remember that 84% of all the teachers in this country, public school teachers, are white people, white men and white women, primarily white women. White women themselves make up 85% of the white teachers. So all these people, what would they do for a living? No, they have to keep, you know, teaching. And teaching us, and it's a disaster because these teachers bring into the classroom all their negative assumptions and expectations, and I think that's something that we really have to look at very, very, very seriously. Who is teaching our children? You know, someone said we were. In his book, that if someone walks up to you and asks you to borrow your car, you will actually refuse to let them take your car. And you will refuse to let them borrow your car, someone you don't know, because you don't know, you know how they drive, right? And you will not trust them with your car. But someone you don't know tells you, let me teach your child, and you let them do it. Yeah, you know nothing about that person, those teachers. You know nothing about them. What are their values? What type of people are they? Are they insane? Are they, you know, are they mean-spirited? What are they? Very racist? Are they evangelical Christian? Are they going to use, you know, their authority to brainwash your child? I mean, what exactly, you know, who are these people with whom your child is going to spend 6, 7, 8 hours every day? So we really have to look at this very, very seriously. And I will tell you this, you know, honestly, I think that we need to divest from public schools and private schools, to be honest. They are not any better. For us, if public schools, you know, close down, maybe that would force us to face the reality and then take the responsibility, claim the responsibility for educating our children in our hands again. Because the way the system is set up is really against us.
You put this on a personal level, saying, hey, I'm not just talking about this as an educator or someone spectating. I am a black mother. Did you at any point have your children in the public school system, or did you make that decision from the very beginning that you were not going to place your child into these institutions?
I have three children, and my very first one, really, I don't even know if I ever heard of homeschooling, but when he was born, I made a point of always having him in an Afrocentric school. It was a private school. I believe that, you know, we have to pay for what we need. And so, you know, I paid every month this Afrocentric school. And, or a school that claimed to be Afrocentric, it was very important for me that my children would always have black teachers. I mean, that was very, very important to me, precisely because I didn't want anybody to question my children's intelligence, ability to do, you know, whatever, math or reading. I didn't want that. So that was a very, very important to me. My oldest one spent 3 or 4 years at that school, and then I decided to take him out. It was not because of racism, but it was becoming, the amount of homework was becoming ridiculous. He was only 8 years old, and he had 2 or 3 hours of homework, silly homework, just to keep him busy. And quite honestly, you know, I did not find the teachers to be, you know, knowledgeable enough about Africa. In fact, I had several, you know, issues with some of the things he would bring home. So this is how it happened, you know. My issue with school was with schooling itself. You know, why the loading our children with all that stuff, and they're not allowing them to really enjoy learning, and they have to learn about dinosaurs, learn about these things that are of no interest to them. But when I pulled him out, I said, well, you know, we'll find the right school for you. But we kept looking. We never found the right school because the right school doesn't exist. And so from the time he was 8 until he went to college, when he was 18, then he was educated at home. And the other two, that was the same thing. All of them went to school for 1 year or 2 years. We were always an Afrocentric school, charter school or private school. I would not have sent my children to a regular public school because, again, of the curriculum, what they would have not learned and what I would have had to undo, and under the many arguments I would have gotten, you know, in with the teachers and the administrators, I felt I had better things to do with my time and energy. So, you know, they never went to public school, per se, only charter schools.
Wow. Wow. So when you decided, hey, I'm even going to pull my, you said your first child, I'm going to pull them out of this Afrocentric school that they had been for a few years because they were doing a lot of, had a lot of homework and you felt just busy work that they didn't needed. Did you begin homeschooling at that point? And were you the one that was doing the instruction?
Absolutely.
Wow.
The first year we had to cleanse ourselves from all that schooling, you know, just to really instill in him again the joy and the desire to learn, because that was being taken away from him, and that was really very very critical for me, you know, that my child should always be eager to learn. And when I saw that light, you know, disappear in his eyes, and when I saw that he was burnt out and he was not interested in anything anymore, I said, no, I will not allow them to do this to this little boy. And I just pulled him out. And again, he never went back. He would ask every once in a while, and I would always say, okay, we'll see. But, you know, I had no intention of sending him back to school, especially with a male, black male. I said, no way, no way. I mean, I heard enough stories, horrible stories, you know, around me to know that no. I want him to be, you know, self-confident, self-assured, know that whatever he wanted to do, if he applied himself, if he worked hard towards it, he could do it. And, you know, and I knew that if he went to school, they would really try to undermine that and take that away from him to the point where he would lose, you know, his ambition and his, you know, his drive to succeed, you know, at whatever he wants to do.
Wow, that...
He's 21 years old now.
Wow. Wow. That is just, it's critically important. It cannot be overstated. In the system of racism where white educators, racist educators, where they take away that joy of learning, where so many black students just end up having a really poor relationship with school, with learning, with education. And I mean, that has devastating lifelong consequences when the first, I mean, formative years of your life, your formative years of existence and brain development, you end up having a really bad relationship with learning, reading, teachers, school, I mean, just devastating lifelong implications of that. As you just said, I mean, just totally can ruin your ambition and your drive and just your joy for learning. It's so rare that I bump into black, I would say people on the whole, but since we're just focused on black children right now, it's so rare to bump into black children that still had that just joy, just genuinely happy and enthusiastic about learning. Like, hey, this is great. I'm learning something. This is wonderful. Just can you touch on that again? Because I think that's so important.
Absolutely. You know, and one of the things that children who go to school complain about is that it is boring. It is really boring. And I always ask myself, you know, when will they do a survey, you know, of children who go to school and ask them how they really feel about going to school? I became aware of this because my children's friends are so envious of them because they are homeschooled. And they always say, you know, if only my parents would do this for me, if only they would stop sending me to school. I don't like going there. The only thing I like is because I can see my friends. but they don't talk about what's going on in the classroom. They say it's boring. They don't feel like being there. It's of no interest to them. And I'm like, wow. I mean, you know what it does to a person to grow up? You spend hours and hours every day, 5 days a week, in a place that where you do not want to be, where you there's no joy being there other than, you know, seeing your friends during recess. And how that shapes your relationship, like you were saying, with knowledge, with learning. And you associate that with boredom and something that you do out of obligation, maybe to please your parents, but this is not something that you really want to do because, you know how children are so happy and excited to go to school when they are little. And then after 3 or 4 years, that light is gone from their eyes. It's gone. The teachers, the school, they have really destroyed that. And it has really lifelong implications. People who could have really done great things, who had a great potential, all this goes down the drain because of schooling. You know, this institution, this process of schooling, which is basically, getting people to take orders, teaching them to take orders, teaching them not to think, teaching them not to ask questions about anything, teaching them to really fit in a box that has been designed for them, teaching them what their place is in the society, and basically crushing their spirit. This is what it does. It crushes their spirit. And so again, how do you repair this? How do you undo that damage? I don't have the answer to this.
Me either, but I definitely think it is important and something people should think about, not just if you have children. Really, ideally, it's something you should think about before you have children.
Yeah.
So that you can implement that plan if we're thinking seriously, because I think that's one of the best things you can do to fight against racism, to have a plan before the child is even conceived. Both black father, black mother, we sit down and we think out first 10 years of our child's life and academic development, what it's going to look like, how are we going to school the child, all of that, plan that before the child is even here. That a plus in working against racism, white supremacy, that would have a profound impact. For sure. Because you wrote in the article, that while finding, this is for parents who are black parents that are turning to homeschooling, you write, while finding ready-to-use educational materials can be challenging, most parents reported creating their own materials by drawing from different resources, such as books, documentaries, the internet, field trips, etc. Did you have those same problems finding resources for your children? And what did you kind of turn to, or what did you produce yourself?
You know, it helped me a lot because I'm a professor of African American Studies. So I say that, I already had a lot of information and books I could pull from. But I feel that homeschooling has never been so easy as it is today. You know, I compare with my oldest one who's 21 and my youngest one who is 11. These are two different experiences for me as a homeschooling parent, because the internet has made available so many resources, documents, there are videos, there are PowerPoints, there's a lot of information that you can really pull together and create really great lessons for your children. One thing that I do, there are different philosophies of teaching, but my own philosophy is that homeschooling should be child-driven. By this, I mean that my job is not to impose what I think they should study, but to listen to my children carefully and listen to them and hear what it is they are interested in. You see? My daughter, for example, told me that she was interested in eyes. So we studied the eyes for about 2 or 3 months. We really got into it. Then they wanted to learn about intelligence, so we studied intelligence. They went to writing poetry, so we do a lot of that. And I have found this to be very rewarding for them and for me, because they really want to learn about this, so there's no struggle. you know, as opposed to, you know, you go to school and they tell you you're going to learn about this, you're going to learn about that. I mean, that may be of no interest to you. Why are you forced to study this particular topic? Whereas in a homeschool, you have the luxury of studying what the child wants to study. And that is really a beautiful experience because they want to do it, and you as the parent teacher, you also learn a lot with them because you have to do some research so you can share that knowledge, and it's a beautiful experience.
Wow. Wow. That is amazing. That is amazing. And totally contrary to, I think, the type of experience that most of us have where you just have to learn about all this stuff, as you said, that is irrelevant to our lives, particularly irrelevant to our situation dealing with racism, or just things that are not really going to have any practical value to help us as in our existence on this planet. I think that's also a major contributor to the boredom that you were talking about earlier, and just not having.
Absolutely. You know, you have to read books that do not reflect your reality, don't talk about you, that, you know, talk about people you have no idea about. And all that contributes to the thing that really strikes me the most about my children, but I've heard the story again and again, how excited they are about learning. They can't wait, you know? And I think this is so beautiful. I know, you know, not successful. I say, well, because for me, that's the most precious thing. You know, they will leave my house, but hopefully they will always have this drive to learn, to grow, you know? And I think that's something that homeschool children tend to have, you know, this desire, again, because they are excited about learning. Learning is exciting. Learning about things we don't know about, it's beautiful.
Absolutely. If I may ask, what is your 21-year-old child doing now?
My 21-year-old child is a third-year student at Georgia Tech. Institute of Technology. He is studying to become an aerospace engineer. He had always, ever since he was a little boy, a passion for planes. Part of it is because we traveled a lot. You know, I see that as part also of their education. So I always try to take him places, you know, with me. And I always made that part of his curriculum. For example, you know, we studied socialism and revolution, and so we went to Cuba after that to see what it looks like. You know, and so different things like that. Whenever, you know, we had the privilege of going to Egypt, you know, so we had studied, of course, you know, the Nile Valley civilization extensively before going, and so on and so forth. But he had a passion for planes ever since he was 5 years old, and he always knew he wanted to work with planes. He became a licensed pilot, and I say this because he had the time to do that, because he didn't go to school. He didn't have to, you know, do all that silly homework that to keep him busy and learning about, you know, white people. You know, that was really not a focus on our homeschool at all. So he could become a licensed pilot, and then when he went to college, he wanted to pursue this. So that's what he's doing. And hopefully, you know, he will be an engineer at some point. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Please continue.
No, I was saying that I'm also saying this to reassure people that you can be educated at home and be successful, quote unquote, right? People think that, you know, somehow you will fall behind, that you're not going to get what you need, and that's not true at all. In fact, studies show that children, especially black children who are homeschooled, do better you know, sometimes people send their children to school for high school, and those children are really way ahead of those who were schooled. So, again, you know, just to alleviate a fear that people might have, you know, if I do this, you know, will my child not learn what they're supposed to learn, and so on and so forth. This is really not the case at all.
Wow. That is amazing. And particularly within the context of there have been so many reports for years now where they're saying, oh, my goodness, we just don't have enough black scientists and black students, black scholars who are interested in math, the stem cells, math and science. And we're just not getting black scholars in those directions. And that's exactly what your child is doing and seemingly extremely proficient in that area. Like, we should just send them to Dr. Mazama and we'll get this problem corrected. That is amazing.
Well, I don't know about that, but what I knew that what was very important to me and his father was to protect again his sense of self-confidence. That was extremely important, you know, to know, yes, you can be good at math, you know, and we will not allow anybody to make you doubt yourself, you know. And so we were very protective of that. There was a point where we could not teach him anymore, so we had to really hire tutors because we knew what he wanted to do. And honestly, you know, I could not teach him the math or physics that he needed to master in order to get into that school, you know. So, but we always made sure that the tutors were always black. That was very, very important to us, always black. And you know, any white person coming and telling my son that, you know, directly or indirectly, that black people cannot excel at math or science, I was not going to have it. We have to be very protective of our children because, again, of the society that we live in, which really wants to make our children, basically the plan is for them to be in prison. So we have to be very in prison or dead. So we have to be very clear about that and be very proactive on our own behalf to make sure that doesn't happen to our children, other black children as well.
Wow. Spectacular, spectacular. What response would you give to people who say, you know, hey, Dr. Mazama, it sounds like you did just a spectacular job with your children, did and are doing a spectacular job with your children. However, I'm concerned. You said, you know, you made an effort to make sure that your children had black tutors and black teachers. That was very important to you. I'm sure your son that's at Georgia Tech now, they probably will have a white teacher at some point if they haven't already. We're concerned if we have our children in such an isolated, restricted environment that they might have problems when they get out into the quote-unquote real world and they have to have white teachers, white tutors, white students to be around and to function in that environment. What would your response be to that?
My response would be that my child, and I teach my children to recognize racism when they see it and not to accept it. So if my son feels that he's being discriminated against because he's black, then he's more likely to go and challenge that situation than a child who would have been trained all his years to accept it somehow and go along. Because we have to challenge white people's racism. We have to. We cannot accept it. It is unacceptable. And there have been, you know, situations at Georgia Tech where he told me that he felt it was racism and it was addressed. Because we don't want, again, to accept this. Now, my response also is that because for 18 years I was able to nurture him, nurture his sense of self, his confidence as a black male, it's going to be very difficult for a white person to come along now and make him feel very small and make him feel that he cannot do as well, if not better, than the white students who struggle, you know, in the classroom with him. And, you know, I've not heard him say that he could not do well at Georgia Tech. He said it's a hard place, but they all, you know, they all suffer. But he's not saying that he's going to give up because he's black or anything like that. So I feel that those, you know, like you were talking about, those very formative years are very, very important. And I know that, you know, he has, again, this confidence, self-confidence, no arrogance, but self-confidence that, yes, I can do this if I apply myself. And that's what he's doing.
Wow. Absolutely brilliant. What recommendations, and I see some folks dialed in, we'll get to callers who have questions, but just what recommendations would you give to parents? Because I know a lot of people, we certainly have a lot of single-parent households where it's just one parent and they have a lot of commitments, don't have a lot of time trying to work and take care of so many things. What recommendations would you give to people who say, hey, just for me right now, homeschooling is just not going to be an option, or it would be extremely difficult because I work, I'm a single parent, I don't have the resources, I don't have the time, or maybe I don't even feel it's adequate. You're, you know, a professor, you have a doctorate, you've done, you know, great with your own academic career. I didn't have that sort of training, that sort of research, that sort of opportunity to learn. So I just don't even feel as skilled, as knowledgeable to teach my child the things that they would need to know. What would you recommend for a person in that sort of situation?
Well, I would recommend that they try to network with other parents who might be interested in pulling their children out of school. I think it's would be the first thing to do. You know, try to create a small group of people who are like-minded and see how you could work it out around your respective schedules, you know, and maybe take turns and help each other. I have met, because when I did the book on African-American homeschooling, it was African-American homeschooling motivations, challenges, and opportunities. I went around the country and interviewed 74 black families, homeschooling families, and I met several of them who were headed by, you know, single mothers. Some of them said that they worked at night, so they could be with their child in the daytime. Some of them worked from home. Some of them had their mother moved in with them, you know. So there were several possibilities, several scenarios there that people used in order to do what they felt was really very, very important, and which was not to let their child go to school and be destroyed by the school system. I would say this. We may think that we're very busy and we don't have time, but if we don't make the time today for our children, we will have lifelong consequences that we will drag behind us, you know, and we will pay a very dear price for not having protected our children, you know, and we will regret that dearly and bitterly, and rightly so. And then we have an obligation also towards our children, which is to protect them. We brought this into the world. We must take care of them. And that means making sure that no white person or system of white supremacy is destroying their hopes, destroying their ambitions, destroying their potential, destroying their dreams, destroying their ability to live, you know, a full life. So I personally take this very seriously. Homeschooling, I'm not going to make it sound like it's always easy. It's not. But sending your child to school and seeing your child being destroyed by the school system is not easy, and I would say it's even more difficult. So what do we do?
Context of white supremacy, Dr. Amma Mazama. We will nab some of the folks who dialed in. Again, I want to encourage black parents or black educators, or even if you're a grandmother or niece, excuse me, aunt, uncle, whomever, if you have black children that you're concerned about and, you know, want to get some questions in or advice, suggestions on things that you can be doing to make sure that they have the best opportunity to improve, excel academically, chime in. The number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you have a question. Let's see, I think this is Thomas in New York. Thomas in New York, did you have a question for Dr. Mazama? You should be with us.
Good evening. Have you heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, good evening, Gus. Good evening to the doctor.
Good evening.
I just want to say, man, that was one of the most amazing things I ever heard when you said you taught your son about socialism and revolution. So you took him to Cuba. And I mean, I was just like, wow, that's like so amazing. I wish I had the time and resources to homeschool my kids and myself. I have two questions for you. The first one is, did your son have to take state standardized testing during the course of your homeschooling?
Yes, in the state of Pennsylvania, it's mandatory, but honestly, you know, it really is not enforced, you know, so if you want to do it, you do it. If you don't do it, it doesn't seem like anybody is asking you any questions. You know, that's my experience, I guess, because I've been doing it for 13 years. But, he did it. He did it because we want him to have that experience, you know, knowing what it's like to be in a classroom and with, you know, those multiple choice questions. So, you know, he went through the process. And it really was not challenging at all. Again, homeschool children do much better on those tests. In fact, he took a course at a community college when he was 15 years old. And he had to be tested to get in, and they had him take the test twice because they couldn't believe that the score that he got. You know, they said it was so high they couldn't believe it, but he didn't even prepare for it. He just went and did it. But again, there's nothing exceptional about him. It's just the training that they get because, you know, we have time to really stay on a topic, you know, so they learn, whatever they learn, they really master it for the most part, you know, as opposed to this really cursory, quick survey of, you know, factual information in schools, which really does not prepare students for college work as well as they should.
Okay, great. My second question for you, because you said that you did some schooling in France, and I was thinking here, Black Americans say that they don't experience racism in France. I just wanted to know, what kind of racism did you encounter there? And how would you compare, you know, the racism in France to the United States? I mute my line. Thank you for taking my call, Gus.
Did you say that Black people, black people experience lots of racism in France, but the situation is a little bit different in the sense that France is really thinks that it's the white country. I say thinks because there are more and more Black people too. At least 20% of the people population of France is, you know, people of color, and it's growing every day. But in France, they will not stop you, for example, from getting into graduate school. They will let you get your PhD, but they will not give you a job. So you get a PhD and you're expected to leave, go back to your country. Here, they would try to do everything they can to prevent you from getting any degree at all. So there's something more systematic here, something maybe, you know, more oppressive, you know, an open and not so open way than in France. I had never experienced anything like what I have experienced since, you know, before coming to the United States. And yet France is a very racist country, don't get me wrong. But here there's something very, very hostile, very harsh, very brutal about white supremacy, I felt.
Hmm. Right on. Let's see. Appreciate that. Thomas in New York. Person that dialed in, let's see, last four digits, 5301, 5301. Did you have a question for Dr. Mazama? You should be with us.
Good evening. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir, Mr. Demi-Four. Good to hear from you.
Thank you. Just a question, because I live in New York, and we homeschool our daughter for the first few years. And as a result, we realized that she needed the socialization with other children, more specifically Black children. And we put her into an African-centered school. And interestingly enough, her African-centered school, after about a year of her being in there, and this school was in existence for over 30 years because our neighborhood is experiencing gentrification, they began to get non-Black students, white students more specifically. So now that she's been there for 2 years, they have maybe about 46 students total. So they have maybe about six white students. And I wanted to know, as a parent who homeschools your child, what sort of scenarios did you experience on the playground with taking your child out for socialization? I mean, because I hear a lot of parents who homeschool their children, they talk about the most difficult aspect is when they take their children out recreationally on the playground, and I wanted to know if you could share some of that, how your children interacted with other children on the playground.
Yes. Thank you so much for your question. What most parents say, you know, when I was doing my research and asking them questions, was that they felt that their children were much more gentle. There was much less aggressiveness on their part because they were homeschooled. And, you know, we can understand why, because the children go to school, they have to stand their ground, you know, they have to defend themselves and so on and so forth. And homeschool children do not have that particular experience. They don't have peer pressure, so there's no need for them to develop, you know, coping mechanisms, you know, such as, again, you know, being, you know, aggressive, you know, verbally or physically, you know, abusive or aggressive. So they are much more gentle. So when they mix with children who go to school, of course, that can create a challenge. I personally never had really this situation because in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia in particular, there are many, 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 maybe even too many places where homeschooled, black homeschooled children meet, gather. You know, there are classes at the Science, you know, Institute. There are classes at the tennis club, I mean, the golf clinics, science classes, art classes for homeschooled children. And so I never had any problem. Again, you know, sometimes I wish there were fewer activities to choose from. And socialization is really not a problem at all, in the sense of finding other black children that they can interact with, which is very necessary. And so, you know, I recognize that, but we haven't had any particular challenges, and I haven't heard other black parents in Philadelphia complain about that either.
Just follow up. With my daughter, she's 4 years old, and her teacher, she's in pre-K now, and her teacher, she just recently passed the New York City Gifted and Talented Test. And her teacher says that just in her observation, she's at least on the level of a third or a fourth grader. And what I find is that because we're so intense in terms of what we do with her academically at home, because even though she attends school now, we still have a homeschool curriculum. I find that when she goes to school and she interacts with other children, she's bored, or they're oftentimes saying that she's disruptive to the academic setting because she, you know, she's looking at the other children and the things that they're learning, like writing their name and stuff like that. And she's already reading, she's already designing coding apps for an iPad, and she's already doing science, and she knows biology, and she's doing four languages already. So it seems like she's bored. So do you think that sometimes the homeschooling can be a hindrance to a child when you introduce them into a school setting later?
Yeah, I think most homeschool children are way ahead, as I was saying before, you know. And so what's going to happen to your daughter is that little by little she will be pulled back. And it is understandable. The teacher cannot handle students who have, you know, such a big gap. And so what's going to happen is that she's going to lose her edge to the point where she's going to become like the rest of them. And that's really a problem with schooling. You know, if you have a very bright child or a child that is struggling, the classroom is really not the best, you know, the best place for that child. The child becomes bored and the child starts, you know, losing interest in what's going on and in learning. And they start acting up. But I know it's a personal thing, but I also would like maybe to tell you to also let your daughter be your child, you know? Let her enjoy life. Let her figure things out. Let her tell you what she wants to learn, you know? Because you don't want to burn her out, you know, and also make it difficult for her to fit, you know, in with other children her age. You know, other kids will also be jealous, you know, envious or whatever, and that's going to create problems for her.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Appreciate that. That is not Mr. Demery Four. That is S-Dot. My apologies, mixing up our callers. Person that dialed in, last four digits, 9769, 9769. Did you have a question for Dr. Mazama?
Yes. Good evening, Gus and Dr. Mazama.
Good evening.
Dr. Mazama, my question is for black males and black females who are planning to have offspring, where should go into planning their children's education? Like, how should they go about that? Like, if one parent wants to do homeschooling.
If the parents want to do homeschooling?
Yeah, so if, like, one person wants to do homeschooling, like, how should they go about planning their children's education?
Well, you know, I think you should really sit down and ask yourself, you know, what type of person would you like your child to be? And you know, and then based on that, you know, come up with a strategy to achieve that goal. What qualities, you know, what type of character, and so on and so forth. And then, you know, start also wondering what about your own understanding of what learning entails. Do you think that's important for parents or adults to be heavily involved in the teaching, or do you think it's better to let your child discover things on their own and enjoy that and become curious about the world around them? Do you think that knowing a lot of facts is more important than thinking maybe critically? So, you know, all these are important questions, and once you answer those questions for yourself, then you can design, you know, a program, of educational program for your child. You know, if, like the caller who called before, you're want to introduce four languages and science at a very early age, if you think that learning to read and write, you know, at 2 years of age is very important, then you can do it. But if you think, and I'm on that side, you know, that it's not so important, that the child will learn to read and write at some point, not too late, but they will eventually do that, that you would prefer for them to explore things freely, then you would approach things a bit differently, you know. My case, you know, we took our son, you know, for long rides, bus rides, and he would just look around and ask questions and would answer. His father would take him to the zoo, and they would spend a whole day there looking at animals, talking about animals. You know, there are so many things, and it's a lot of fun when they, especially when they are young, because you don't have to worry so much about, at least in my opinion, you know, something very structured, you know, just go with the flow. Again, you answer their questions, and you encourage them to ask questions. And that's not difficult, because children are naturally inquisitive. They want to learn. They want to know. They always ask why. And you answer to the best of your ability.
Okay. Just one more question. What books or authors would you recommend for educating black children?
It depends on the topic, you know, and depends also on the age of the child. There's a book that I produced along with Dr. Asante and a former student of mine, and we call it African Foundations. And we produced that book in English, in French, and in Portuguese, because the needs of our children are the same whether we are in Brazil, in Guadeloupe, or in the United States. And that's a book that I would recommend, because it's a book that I produced, I consider myself because I needed it for my children, I realized that, you know, black parents needed it as well. So, you know, I put it together, and it's a book about biographies of you know, significant black people, starting from ancient Africa and moving to the United States, present-day United States, and it has vocabulary, reading comprehension, critical thinking, and so on and so forth. That's one book I will recommend. But again, especially when they're young, the key is to put things together. There are many black books for children, you know, fiction books. Some of them are really excellent, you know, nice pictures, nice illustrations. So it takes a little bit of time, but really not that much now with the internet. So I would definitely urge you to surround your children with black, you know, positive black examples, you know, and always starting with them and they are, who they are, you know, to teach them about whatever you want to teach.
Okay.
The child should always know they are the center of the learning process.
Mm. All right. Thank you, Dr. Nozama.
You're very welcome. You're very welcome.
Appreciate that question as well. Questions? Guest from last week, Devin, should be dialing in, black parent. Did you have any questions for Dr. Mazama? You should be with us.
Hi, Gus. This is actually Norma.
Oh.
I want to thank the guest for being on the show tonight.
For sure, for sure.
I do have a question for the guest. My question is, what do you think would be the proper or correct age to educate your child, frankly, about the system of racism, white supremacy as a system?
I really think it's never too early. We have to teach them where they are, so when they recognize it, they do not blame for themselves for what is going on. The insanity and the madness, you know, of white people around them has nothing to do with them. And you make them very aware. I start teaching my children about this, you know, very early, you know, and this is part of our almost daily conversation. Well, we talk about racism, we talk about white supremacy, but we also talk, it's not an obsession, so we talk about, you know, what they try to do to us to really prevent us from being who we should be, who we could be, and we have this conversation on a regular basis. I also talk to my children a lot about the fact that white people are disappearing, and, you know, so I encourage them to imagine a world, right, where white people would be really very tiny minority, and what this world would be like for them, you know, as African children, what it would be for, what it would mean for Africa, how we must organize, take care of ourselves, and so on and so forth. So I help them put things in perspective as well, so they don't feel overwhelmed by this, you know, this system, white system of domination. But I think they have to be very, very much aware of it so that they can protect themselves as well from it. Being in denial is not helpful at all.
Thank you, sister, for your answer.
You're welcome.
Thank you for being on the show.
Have a good night.
Good to hear from you, Norma. My apologies, assuming I thought I was her partner, Devin. Good to hear from both of you, though. Retired firefighter in Florida. I guess before I get to him, I'll give out the number again. Really encourage, if there are parents out there, if you all have questions, looking for suggestions, thoughts, that sort of thing, definitely take advantage, chime in. The number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you have a question. A retired firefighter in Florida. Did you have a question for Dr. Mazama? You should be with us.
Greetings, everyone.
Greetings.
Greetings.
My question is up on the collegiate level. I'd like to just ask the guest of her opinion of what do you think on how historical black colleges can improve on their development of, especially the, of course, the majority non-white black students in their development to prepare them for something other than quote-unquote corporate America, but to be able to, with the training and education that they get on that level, that they can bring those talents and skills back into the areas where non-white black people are at. Could you just give us some of your thoughts on that subject?
Can you be more specific? First of all, I really don't like the term non-white. You know, we were just having this conversation. We are not non-white or black. You know, we never hear white people call themselves non-black, you know? So I think we have to really let that go, if you ask me. But I would like to be more specific. What is exactly your question?
I was asking about if you have an opinion about the historical black colleges on what mm-hmm. can they do to better develop non-white black students to go back into the areas where they are came from to participate in developing, making the area better based on the skills and or training that they had while they were in college. Do you have any ideas or opinions about that?
Yes, yes. Well, what I think that the one thing that's very important, but that is very much lacking, you know, at HBCUs is really the teaching black students about their history and culture. I don't know, there may be one or two HBCU that has actually an African or African-American studies department. I mean, Howard is one, but other HBCUs don't feel the need for that. So you have black students who come knowing very little about their history and culture and really not having much regard for it because, of course, they've been subjected to years and years of schooling where they've been told that all that matters really is Europe and whiteness. So that is to be expected. And those HBCUs really do not do anything or very little to really correct that situation. The question really that many homeschooling parents are asking is how can you be educated, consider yourself educated, if you know nothing about yourself? And so I think that would be the first, you know, step for me to ground those black students in their history and culture and explain to them really where they come from, that they have the longest history in the world as black people. Nothing to be ashamed of, nothing to feel inadequate about, you know. But I don't see HBCUs do that. But to me, that's very fundamental, because if you don't have that knowledge, you don't have that self-confidence, that confidence self as a black person, you know, you will always be very shaky, and you will be always be very vulnerable to the assaults of white supremacy. So I would start there, strengthening our core, ourselves as black people. And then everything else will fall into place.
Right on.
That was your only question, retired firefighter?
That'll be all for right now.
Right on. Caller at 0949. Did you have a question for Dr. Mazama? You should be with us.
Hi, yes. Hi, Dr. Ama Mazama. I'm a caller and listener of the show. I would like to know if you can elaborate a bit more on the use of African spirituality, whether it's Yoruba, Ifa, Wudong, to combat white supremacy.
Good evening. Yes, this is a question that we always ask publicly or, you know, privately, you know, how can we use our spirituality as a weapon to really get ourselves out of this very difficult situation? You know what? Honestly, it can be done in what's done in Haiti. This is how the Africans in Haiti were able to free themselves in large part. And so suddenly it can be done again. And you know, it's not that we don't use it on a personal level, to be honest with you, but what we have to do really is come up with, you know, a collective plan, you know, and this is what's missing, because we don't have that in place. But it's quite feasible and it's quite possible, of course. Yes.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
For sure. Let's see, I will nab any other callers, any other hands as I see them. I know that you also have talked about, you've kind of shared as we've been discussing this evening, the significance, the importance of including content so that Black children learn about their history on this planet, and that can go a long way to making sure that they have a sense of self-respect, Black self-respect, self-confidence, and not feeling, you know, inferior and we haven't accomplished anything and just, you know, Black people are incompetent in comparison to whites. What sort of content specifically? I know you talked about with your child that you all went to Egypt, and you all, before you even went, you had extensive study of Nile Valley civilization. Like, what sorts of things would you recommend to make sure that Black parents teach their children about the history either of the continent or just Black people in general?
Both, you know, African people, you know, Black people, Africa, you know, I always start with this, that human life started in Africa, period. You know, and that, you know, 30,000 years ago, there were no white people. That all people, you know, in the world come from Africa, come from Black people, come from African people. So we are the parents, you know, of all other human beings. It's very ironic that, you know, now we have some people who descend from us who really try to boss us around, you know, that's like, you know, children trying to boss around their parents. It doesn't make sense. But we start with that, you know, life started in Africa, you know, and then there were migrations out of Africa, and then, you know, we take it from there. But we insist, you know, on Africans having the longest history in the world, period. You know, period. 200,000 years ago, that's when Homo sapiens emerged in Africa. There's only one place in the world where it happened. It was in Africa. So when you arm your child with that knowledge, you see, it gives them a different sense of what is really going on and where they fit in this whole scheme. Because you go to school in the United States and elsewhere, they teach you that your history started in 1619 as, you know, slaves of white people. And this is not correct. Because when you participate in that particular narrative and you accept this particular historiography, what that does to you is that makes you very small, and it makes you exist only in relation to white people who were your masters on top of it. That is not empowering. I don't know of any child who wants to hear that and who is expected to feel good about that. Because on top of it, they don't even show you your enslaved ancestors fighting and resisting and winning. Like, let me go back to the French example. They teach about France in the 19th century. So I looked at a textbook that they use in Guadeloupe, and there's not one single mention of the defeat that the French suffered in Haiti at the hands of Africans who were able to overthrow the system of slavery. They don't mention it in that book. Nothing. So if you will think, okay, I come from slaves, and those slaves basically were totally subjugated, totally suppressed, totally oppressed, totally dominated by white people, and maybe it wasn't so bad because they didn't fight back. You got it all wrong. And what it does, and what the ideas, the conclusions that you draw from this, are really not positive ones, and they're really not going to inspire you. They're going to strengthen you. They're not going to protect you from racism at all. For you, what you're experiencing is the normal continuation, you know, like a destiny, that as Black people we are destined to be dominated by white people. It's not the case at all. When you learn your long history, you know the battles, you know the fights, you know the victories, you also know about the defeats, but you also know about the spirit of resistance, then you understand that, okay, this is a difficult moment we are in, but it certainly shall pass. And we're going to do everything. We're going to exercise our own agency to make sure that it, you know, our domination or our being dominated ends sooner than later. And keeping our children home to build them as strong African people, giving them a sense of confidence, will make this happen, or is part of this process of fighting and not accepting, you know, white racial supremacy as our destiny.
Ashe, ashe. That right into one of the other questions I wanted to ask, but I mean, that's hugely important. We just, one of the books that we read in our book club, they were talking about how this was a strategic act of racism to make sure that the Haitian Revolution is not taught, not discussed, so that people do not have that in mind. Like, oh, wow, black people fought back and defeated whites militarily in a battle, and not just with the Haitian Revolution, but this is done widespread with the Stono Rebellion in South Carolina, with Nat Turner, with Denmark. I mean, just going all down the line, tons of black people, Bambaataa on the continent of Africa, just tons of these where it just doesn't get talked about, so that the impression you're left with is exactly what you said, that black people are just cowards and have not fought back, and they're satisfied with all this, and they're just content to allow white people to continue to abuse and pillage them on into eternity. And nothing could be further from the truth. And it almost seems like that might be answering the question to some degree. But my question I wanted to ask, what are things that are just essential that black parents need to make sure that they do to produce courageous black children who are willing to confront the problem of racism?
They must teach them about black people who've done just that in the past. You know, I remember when my son was like 2 or 3 years old, we would sit on the bed and we would read, you know, Marcus Garvey, you know, and how strong and how courageous, how brave that man was, and how correct he was, you know, his understanding. And I remember my son being in pre-K and talking about Marcus Garvey to his classmates. You know, the teacher was, you know, looking at him and smiled. And I said, yes, if we teach our children at an early age about all those strong black people who have stood up and said, wait a minute, you know, and we've tried to organize us, we've tried to teach us, then it would make a big difference. It would really go a long, long way. And I see it in my son. You know, he's in college, surrounded with white people. There's only 4% black students at that school. A shame. It's in the middle of Atlanta. You would think it would do a bit better. But, you know, I see the choices he makes, and I say, I know it's from the socialization. I know it's from what I taught him. I see it, you know, being involved, you know, in black students' organizations, assuming leadership positions, caring, you know, trying to raise money for black students, black high school students to be able to go to college as well, you know, caring about the community, feeling a responsibility, and knowing it has to be done and that it needs to be done, it will be done. If we taught our children that they have a responsibility because others came before them, who paved the way for them, who sacrificed their lives, who put their lives on the line for them, it would give them a different outlook, and they wouldn't be so mindless and so self-centered and absorbed in silly things. I mean, we're responsible for the children that we produce ultimately. So we need to be very careful. One thing I will say, When I got my first child, I got rid of my TV. I put on the sidewalk and said, this is it. Because, you know, we talk about schools, but we should talk about, you know, media. It's very dangerous as well. And I don't have a TV. I never had one ever since I had children. So we have to make choices. What do we teach them? Who do we want them to be? How do we want them to behave? We have to influence their values, and so on and so forth. That's very, very important. And we must be relentless about this. Because if we are not relentless, there's a system out there which is relentless. and which will grab them and destroy them, and we will have little monsters. We'll have children we don't recognize. We'll have children we're not proud of. We'll have children who will basically break our hearts.
The cows again, Dr. Ama Mazama. Before I get our other caller, I just wanted to emphasize what you said. So many of the things that you said have just been extremely important, but the profundity for Georgia Tech, one of the premier science and engineering institutions in the country, so I've been told, to be in the middle of Atlanta with over a million black people, just tons and tons of black people, for that institute to have 4% enrollment of black students, that right there is further evidence of the system.
Absolutely.
Of white supremacy. Just in what you just said, because I thought that was so important, but I often hear parents, black parents, who will say, well, that sounds all well and good, Dr. Mazama, about teaching about Marcus Garvey or Assata Shakur or David Walker or any number of black people, what happened in Haiti. I don't want my black children to hate white people. I don't want that to happen, because then they'll have problems if they have to go to school or get a job or just go out and function in the world. What's your response to parents who say, hey, I don't want to teach that to my children because they'll end up hating white people?
Well, I don't think my children hate white people, but certainly they don't trust them, and they would be fools to trust them, you know? And it's not out of a negative spirit that I'm saying this, but it's just based on the historical record that white people have drawn for themselves, you see? So, no, it's not a matter of hating anybody. It's not that, but it's a matter really of loving ourselves. That's what I've taught my children. You know, love yourself, love your ancestors, love your place of ancestry, love Africa, be grateful to your ancestors. That's what it's about. In the process, I'm trying to build them up, help them, you know, again, be strong, because I know there's a system out there that wants to destroy them. And I'm adamant that I will not let that happen. So I have to build them up. I have to build them up and give them all the weapons that I can think of so that they can protect themselves and do what they came in the world to do, you know, basically accomplish their mission in the world. So it's not about hating anybody, but it's about loving ourselves. What is very interesting is that in this white racial supremacist world, whenever black people, a black person loves themselves, they are seen automatically as being against white people or against other people. That's not the case. We're just for ourselves. We want to love ourselves. What is wrong with that? Isn't that normal that we should embrace who we are? We should really love being who we are. We should thank God every day for making us who we are. What is wrong with that? Isn't it what other people do?
Absolutely. Just, to me, further emphasizes that the system of white supremacy cannot operate with black people having high levels of black self-respect, confidence, love of self. That just cannot support the system of white supremacy. They do everything they can to make sure they extinguish that. And as we've been talking about, school plays a major part in that process. The person, I think this is Lady in New York, upstate New York, no less. Did you have a question for Dr. Mazama?
Hello. How are you tonight, Doctor?
I'm all right. How are you?
Good. Thank you for asking. Hello, Gus and everyone else on the line. I'm just getting in, so I didn't really get to catch the beginning. So I wanted to know, there are a lot of reading suggestions that I've heard just within the past few minutes. Are you able to maybe put a list together on Facebook, or do you have already a composed list for elementary high school students on African literature or African history that you think that would be vital for them to understand and read and?
You know, honestly, I have not done this, but I understand that there are quite a few groups of African-American homeschoolers online that, you know, share resources and things of that nature. And if you're interested, I would definitely recommend that, you know, you check them out. What I have done, as I said, on my own and with Dr. Asante and a former student of mine, Ibu Shanga, was to really create a textbook for homeschool, for black children, not just homeschool, but for black children ages of from 8 to 13, you know, with, you know, biographies of important, you know, significant African figures. But I have not drafted a list, you know, again, because it's a personal thing as well. There are books that can be written by black people that you may not want your children to read, you know. So there's no shortcut. You know, you have to ask yourself, what do I want my child to be like? And, you know, what will it take for me to take my to get my child there? And you do your homework. This is what he needs to read. This is what she needs to do, and so on and so forth. And then you do it.
And I'm sorry, you were saying that you have a textbook for homeschoolers.
A textbook that's African Sound. It's called African Foundations. And if you are interested, if you can get a copy, going on the site of our organization, which is Afrocentric Studies International, and the site is www.diabukam, and it's spelled D Y A B U K A M. .com. Again, it's dyabukam.com, and you can order the book online there.
Okay, I'm typing it in, but I'm not coming up with the website.
Really?
I'll go to the archives and try to.
Or would you try maybe, no, or maybe diabukam? Can you try that? diabukam? Or D-I-Y-A, so I'm a bit tired. I usually go to bed early and I get up very early so I can do some work. So it's D-I-Y-A-B-U-K-A-M, I'm sorry.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not finding anything.
Nothing?
If you, maybe I'm just with your accent, I'm not hearing it correctly, but, you know, maybe you can send Gus a link or something like that, and he can post it on his site, and I can check it out.
Maybe I'm checking it out as we speak, so let me see. You're right, so the site cannot be reached. I don't know. If you type Afrocentric Studies International, it will come up. Afrocentric Studies International.
Okay, I will definitely check it out and see if it's something I can.
Yeah, it came up here. It's D Y A B U K A M. So I had given the right spelling. dyabukam.com, and it does come up.
Okay.
I got it. I'll
okay.
post it on the.
You got it?
Yes, I got it. I'll post it on the Facebook page, and I'll
okay.
tweet it out as well. Oh, I think I'm looking at the book now, so I will share. Folks can check it out and see if it's some information that you can use. But I'll post it so people can find it easy.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much.
Grant, the person that dialed in 3979. Did you have a question for Dr. Mazama? Caller, last four digits 3979. Did you have a question, or are you just listening in?
Sorry about that, Gus. This is Devin down in Miami, but me and my wife, our other phone kept disconnecting, so we decided to just use her phone.
Oh, okay. No problem. Great. Glad you.
A question, doctor.
Yeah.
Doctor.
Hello.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you now.
Okay. Where are you from?
I'm from Guadeloupe.
Okay. All right. Now, I've been running into a tremendous amount of information lately that has basically been kind of telling me that the people of Africa were kind of enslaved by two major religions, one of them being Islam. Do you think that it is wise to educate your child in, like, how the destruction of black civilization was written, to explain to them how Africa was invaded by the Islamic religion, so to speak?
Oh, absolutely. We have to do this. We have to tell them the truth. We have to tell them that the Arabs enslaved us for about 1,000 years before Europeans came in. So actually, the Arabs enslaved us for a longer period of time than the Europeans did. And we have to tell them how, you know, why it is that, you know, Africans, you know, are Muslim is because, you know, they were really forced. They were forced to convert to Islam, very much like we later were forced to convert to Christianity. You know, it was not a freedom of choice or anything like that at all. So we have to tell them the truth, and we have to tell our brothers and sisters in this country, too. You know, you think that moving to Islam somehow is better than, you know, Christianity, but really, you know, the two of them are very problematic as far as black people are concerned. And we talk about self-respect, but if we have really true self-respect, we will really take our distance, you know, from these two religions. But we are not, we are taught not to have self-respect.
As far as religion goes, what kind of conversations do you have with your children about religion or spirituality?
We have very deep conversations about spirituality. I tell them that the first time that the word, the name for God was created, it was an African name. And basically, we ourselves, we practice a particular African, you know, religious, spiritual tradition, the tradition of Wudun. My oldest son was initiated. And my two younger ones cannot wait to be initiated as well, because they know that it came from Africa, it came from our ancestors, and this is part of our daily life, where we, you know, when we pray to an African God. And we know our ancestors are very much a part of our reality. We thank them on a regular basis for allowing us to be alive. So, yes, we have those conversations quite often. And the children themselves bring it up. You know, I'm not the one saying, you know, it's 8 o'clock on Wednesday, we're going to talk about our ancestors. So it just happens in a very organic way where we just talk about that.
Well, we can't fight this ridiculous office, Dr. Mazama. Thank you for the information. We really appreciate you joining the show this evening.
Okay, thank you so much for listening.
Appreciate that as well. The caller who dialed in at 8910, did you have a question for Dr. Mazama?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Your volume
yes.
is, if you could speak up, that would be helpful.
Okay, just one second. I'm on the speaker, so we fix that.
Can you hear me better?
Yes, ma'am.
Great. Thank you so much for taking my call, Mr. Renegade. And Dr. Mazama, did I pronounce your name right?
Yes, you did it well. Thank you.
Yes, absolutely. And I'll apologize because I'm joining the call late. And I have a question that perhaps you may have already addressed. My question is, I have my husband and I, we have two. I'm a black female, and my husband is a black male. We have two young children. Who currently they are in the public school system. And over the years, I've just begun to notice more and more problems that my children are experiencing in this school system. Most of the children where we live are white. I notice problems that they experience, and I initially didn't attribute them to racism, but the more information I've gotten about racism, I believe some of the things they experienced even when they were very small, even in preschool, were related to racism. And so my question is, what advice could you give for black parents who would like to begin homeschooling their children. Can you give some suggestions on how to begin that process to gather, you know, all the necessary materials to begin the homeschool process? So any insights mm-hmm. or information you could share on that would be so helpful.
Yes. Yes. First of all, I would go on the school district website of whatever state you're in. What, you're in New York, you said?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you, Dr. Mazzola.
What state are you in?
I'm in Pennsylvania.
Oh, you're in Pennsylvania. Okay. So you go on the school district website, and you look for homeschooling requirements, and then, you know, you download whatever there is to download, and then you can, because you can petition the school district in Pennsylvania any time during the year to homeschool your children.
Okay.
If you wanted not to send them to school tomorrow, you have the right to do that. And I think you have 2 weeks to petition the school district and say, you know, I want to take the my children's education in my hands. And so it's, if they... to avoid any problem in the future, any social worker knocking on your door at some point and saying that, you know, you are a delinquent or parent and so on and so forth. And then I would probably take some time just to regroup from schooling, because the schooling experience is a quite a harsh experience, and it's when you stop being involved in that process that you realize how much it had actually taken out of you, you know? So mentally, it drains you. And so you just take some time just to catch your breath and just like, wow, you know? And then I would ask my child, what do they want to learn about? And I would put lessons together based on what they want to learn about. Because it's better if you let the child drive the curriculum as opposed to you trying to impose topics on them. And then you also do not need to spend hours and hours sitting at a table trying to reproduce what's going on in the classroom. You know, my experience is that 2 or 3 hours, depending on the child's age, but you know, 2 or 3 hours of... you know, work, focused work, is more than enough to get what you need to get done for that day. And again, depending on your child's interest, depending on your interest, depending on what strength you yourself have, you know, you should just take it from there and let it flow. It really is not that difficult, you know, it really is not. It really is not. People think it is, and they, you know, they become quite anxious about this. They imagine, you know, all kinds of things, but it really is not. Especially when the children are young, you know, there's but so much they can understand. So you don't need to go really deeply into things, because they will not be able to get that anyway. You know, as they get older, you know, it becomes a bit more challenging. But the good thing about homeschooling children is that they learn to teach themselves at an early age. You know, they will grab a book, they will read the book, they will learn on their own, they will do research on their own. And by the time they reach high school years, they're pretty much on their own, you know. I mean, you supervise it, but they are learning, you know, things at their own pace and things that are more geared towards their own interests and intellectual growth.
Thank you so much. Some of the things you just mentioned really, I think they resonate for me because my husband and I, we already supplement our children's education at home, and mm-hmm. we don't watch very much TV at all. We're very restrictive, and my husband and I, we hardly watch TV ourselves. And so we often already find our children will pick up a book and just start reading. Even our five-year-old, he can read already very, very well. He just turned 5. A few weeks ago, and I had found him just reading a book. I said, where's my son? And he's sitting on his bed reading a book. And so what you're saying makes perfect sense, because once you really develop the environment for your child to just become a learner by eliminating all these distractions, which are so harmful to us as Black people anyway, then they just gravitate to the learning, and they see their dad and me also doing lots of reading, lots of studying, ourselves. So what you say makes perfect sense. And the other thing I just wanted to mention, which I think you said is so helpful, you said just a few hours a day, because my husband and I, we have full-time jobs and we're struggling to figure out how to homeschool
it, yeah.
And making adjustments to our work schedule. And you pointed out that just a few hours a day should be enough. And I think that's so helpful, because the research I've done so far, it says, you know, 6-8 hours a day. And you know, that may be, yeah, and it's 5 days a week. And, you know, we're planning to do weekends, and maybe my husband and I each can take one day out of our current jobs. And so we can teach them maybe 4 days a week for a few hours a day. And self-directed learning, that makes perfect sense, because that's what life is about as an adult. Nobody sits you down to teach you. You have to have that initiative.
Yeah. And it serves them well when they go to college. You see, I'm a college professor, and I see so many of my students being totally lost, you see, because there's no adult, no teacher asking for the homework, no parent around, you know. But when they're homeschooled, they've learned to learn really on their own. And so they're very self-directed and very independent. That's something that parents say again and again, that their children are very independent learners. And they have to. I remember towards the end of my when my son was still at home, I would give him his work like on Monday morning, and I would tell him, you have to do this week, and we'll meet again on Friday. Mm. And that's what we did. Many times, you know, if I had a hectic schedule, you know, this is your work, I would prepare it. This is what I want you to have done by Friday. And I would let him, you know, basically manage his own time. All he knew is that by Friday, he had to have done, you know, what I'd ask him to do. And he did. You know, so now he's in college. I don't have to worry about he's turning his homework, you know, his assignments in time, whether this, whether that, because he is. He's been doing it for so many years. That's natural to him. And that's a very, very, you know, very important skill.
May I just ask one follow-up question, if I may? Do you recommend any specific curriculum or materials to purchase that would be useful for homeschooling for Black children?
No, I have not. Such a curriculum really still needs to be put together, to be honest with you. I myself, I don't know that I would, even if such a curriculum existed, if I would even buy it, because I like the freedom that homeschooling, you know, gives you. You know, and children are different, you know, they are different ways of learning, different things that are of interest to them. So I really like to go with the flow. And it's really not difficult at all, because the internet has so many resources. You know, you would find PowerPoints, you know, PowerPoints already there for you. You can use on whatever topic, you know, you choose. It's amazing. I've seen the difference between, you know, 10 years ago and now. When I homeschool my oldest one, who's 21, and I'm homeschooling my youngest one, who's 11, there's a world of difference, and it's much easier. In fact, there's so much, you know, you have all those worksheets, you know, all those, you have online, you know, interactive, you know, you exercises, you have all those sites for language arts, vocabulary, for this, for that, so science. It's great. It really is great. And you have videos also, you know, that you can use to you know, supplement. You know, so it really is not that. It takes a little bit of planning and organization, but it's not. I don't find it really overwhelming. You know, I work myself. I teach, you know, have many responsibilities, and I don't find myself burnt out, thinking I cannot do this anymore. Not at all. You know.
Okay. Well, I hope one day perhaps you will write a book to help encourage other Black parents to homeschool, because I think so many people are intimidated that it requires a tremendous amount of time and commitment. And
it doesn't. You know, on May 21st, we will have a program precisely to advocate, you know, for homeschooling for Black parents. It's going to be on May 21st. At 4:00 at the MK Institute in Philadelphia. I don't know where you
are. Oh, I must come. I must come. I have to find the details. I will come for sure.
And we will definitely be sharing practical. Yeah, we will be sharing practical information with Black parents who want to do it. You know, but needs the little encouragement and push and reassurance that, you know, it really is very feasible. And so the address, if you want, I can give it to you. It's 5535 Drummondtown Avenue in Philadelphia.
Okay, May 21st at 4 p.m.?
May 21st at 4, yeah.
Oh,
it's a
perfect
Saturday.
I will definitely be there. I'm in Pennsylvania, so it will not be a problem. So
okay,
I look forward to finding out more.
Yes, yes, yes.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you so much. This is
Oh, you're very
helpful.
Welcome. Okay, no problem.
Outstanding. I don't... I think we had one other person who dialed in with a question. I guess this will be our last caller. We don't want to keep Dr. Mazama up too late. She says she likes to go to bed early, and I definitely encourage that one. Our caller.
After you take your caller, can I ask one short question?
Yes, we'll see if we can get that in too. Our caller at 5640. Did you have a question for Dr. Mazama?
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. Dr. Mazama, I was looking on Amazon. I saw you wrote a book called, I forget the title, but did you write a book?
Yeah, I've written several books, but I did write a book on homeschooling, yes. It's African-American homeschooling, motivations, challenges, and opportunities. It came out in 2015, yeah, about a year ago, 6 months ago or so, yeah.
And I saw that one of the contributors was the late Dr. Asa Hilliard, and
you're talking about the Afrocentric paradigm that I wrote edited in 2003, and yes, I had a chapter by Dr. Hilliard in the book talking about the education of black children and the educational model of ancient Africa, yes.
Oh, great, great. I was introduced to him when I was much younger on Howard University's Channel 32, when I don't know if it still exists to this day, but I just wanted to get your view on how it was working with him, because he seemed very knowledgeable of African history and et cetera. Thank you.
Yeah, well, he certainly was a great, great man, and I think there are very few people, you know, who were as concerned about and as committed to educating black children properly. And he had no illusions whatsoever about, you know, what the schools were really about and what public schools in particular, you know, were doing to black children. He had no illusions. So although, you know, he tried to fight within the system, he knew that we were up against, you know, a formidable enemy, and that, you know, we should protest against, you know, what we're experiencing out of principle. You know, he had a problem, of course, with the so many white people being teachers of black students. You know, he didn't think that that was really a very good situation. He had a problem, of course, with us not knowing that our history, you know, that human civilization started in Africa, you know, and so on and so forth. So he was definitely a great champion, you know, for African education and so on and so forth, yeah.
Great. Well, thanks again.
You're very welcome.
Sure. Lady, did you have your quick question you wanted to get in?
Oh, yes, I did. For parents who cannot make it to the Pennsylvania event in May, do you put anything on YouTube so that others can view?
We will probably have overwhelmed. We will have this videotaped, and we will definitely put it, you know, on our YouTube channel, which is Afrocentricity International. We have a YouTube channel, and you should, you know, check it out there, you know, after it has happened, yes.
Excellent, thank you.
But we feel very strongly that we need to encourage other black people, other black parents to really consider homeschooling. Because, again, you know, what our children experience, you know, in school is really not a good thing at all.
Well,
by design, not by chance, but by design, you know. So, you know, we have to do something about it. and we can stay within the system and fight it, you know, but then in the meantime, because the system is very strong, you know, our children are still being damaged.
Outstanding. Again, Dr. Ama Mazama, and posting the YouTube video as well, Afrocentricity International. I'm posting the channel so folks can subscribe and get all the great content if you can't make it out to the meeting in May next month. Just the final question I wanted to get in before we let you go enjoy the rest of your evening. When you mentioned earlier, you were talking about, I think you said approximately 84% of the teachers in the U.S. are white. And of that, about 85% of them are white women specifically. We did a program a while back last year. We had a black educator on, and I said it pretty bluntly. I said, when we talk about the school to prison pipeline, white women are sitting square at the middle of that problem in what's happening with black students. And he said that basically that was inaccurate, and, you know, you can't make a type of statement like that and what have you, even though he did. We were in agreement that white women make up the vast bulk of the teachers here in the U.S., and I just wanted to get your thoughts on that. Do you think it's accurate to say that white women, they are at the center of what they call the school-to-prison pipeline?
Of course they are, yes. They are, you know, and white men, too, you know, often as, you know, school principals and in that nature, of course they are, you know, they are... You know, and I also work sometimes as a consultant, you know, for public schools in the country, you know, public schools. And, you know, when I see the teachers who come, they are white women, and they really know little, very, very little about us, but they have all those ideas about what is wrong with us, you know. So they don't know us, but they know that something is wrong with us. They do not question their own racism. They do not question their own, you know, attitudes. They would deny it all for the most part, but and they are, of course, you know, they play a critical role in this, you know, school to prison pipeline. They play a critical role in discouraging our children, in disenfranchising them, in offending them, and offending the parents as well. You know, so they say, you know, black parents don't go to parent teachers conferences. Yeah, but if you're going to be insulted, why would you go? You know, if you're going to be accused of being a, you know, delinquent parent before you even showed your face, then why would you go to such meeting? Why would you put yourself in that position? You know, I heard that from black homeschooling parents and sharing their experiences. So, yes, of course they play a very, very important role in this, you know. And they should be held accountable for that as well.
Absolutely. I posted the link for folks. You can check out some of the other books that she, Dr. Mazama, has written, African Foundations, Afrocentric Curriculum Infusion. I posted the link. I know people were having some difficulty finding it, but I put it on Facebook. I tweeted it out as well in the YouTube channel. I think I found it. You said the YouTube channel is Afrocentricity International. That's the YouTube channel?
Yes.
I think I have got that as well, so I'll post that on Facebook.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Thank you very much. Yeah.
My pleasure is mine, doing my duty. Really enjoyed having you on the program. Just outstanding information, and I hope we can have you back on a future program in the future. And if you maybe if you just can email me the information, the details about the event that you all are having in May 21st, we can share on the program. I know we have listeners in Pennsylvania, and I will do all I can to encourage them to come out and participate in the event, because I think that's super, super important. So just, yeah, if you can email me the details, we will share on the program.
Yes, thank you so very much. I really appreciate your support, and, you know, we are all in this together. We want the best for our children. We want the best for our people. So thank you very much for your work as well.
Thank you. Really, really appreciate it. Again, our guest, Dr. Ama Mazama. Really, really spectacular information. Just it has been extremely inspiring hearing the work that you've done, the research, and even just the work with your own children. Just awesome, awesome effort. And we will wish you the best. Keep up your outstanding and priceless effort. And we will look forward to speaking with you again soon. Enjoy the rest of your evening, Dr. Mazama.
Thank you so very much, Gus. Good night.
For sure. Good night. Context of white supremacy. excellent, excellent information. I will, as I said, as soon as she gets me the details, I will share on the program and encourage any listeners that we have in the Pennsylvania area. Get out, even, I guess, if you're in New York or other flakes, other areas that are relatively close to the Philadelphia area, maybe you should get down too and hear some of the information that they're going to be giving out. If you are a parent, thinking about being a parent, looking for resources, information to help with your child's academic growth, sounds like the place you want to be, May 21st, next month in Philadelphia. And as soon as I get the information, I'll share. I'll post them on Facebook, and I can forward as well. So, you know, if you're interested, as soon as I get it, I'd be happy to forward it out to folks. If you want to drop me an email, and we'll get the details to you. With that, we will do, I guess, a really quick commercial. Again, I did post the information. I tweeted it as well for the book African Foundations, Afrocentric Curriculum Infusion, that was co-authored by Dr. Mazama. The website, she gave out the address earlier. If you're having any difficulty locating it, I have it, and I have it linked specifically to that book. You can check on the site if there are other materials that you want to check out and what have you. The only caveat, as she said, she has this book published in French, Portuguese, English. You just want to make sure. I think this is the one that's published in English because the title that they have for this book is in English, so I would assume that the rest of the book would be in English as well. The other books, the titles are not in English. They're in French or whatever respective language. So I think this is the English version. I think they have a tab that you can click if you have any questions or just want to make sure that you get the correct version of the book that you can read and get take advantage of all the information included in the text. But the link should be on my Twitter page, at Until Justice, at Until Justice. You can get the information there. I also posted on Facebook. If you have any difficulties, confusion, if you're listening in the archives and, you know, have whatever difficulties finding it, just let me know and I can drop you an email with that information. But it should be posted, and I will post the YouTube channel as well for folks. If you can't make it to the event next month, at least you can see the recording of the information. With that, we'll do a quick commercial break. Be back if any folks have any comments, questions that they would like to get in about what they heard this evening. Context of White Supremacy. We will be right back.
RacismDaily.com, your number one source for global news reports on race, racism, and overt actions of white supremacy. From Asia to the Americas to Europe to Australia to Africa, racism is not a thing of the past. It is our current reality. Be informed. Be globally informed. You should be the first to know. RacismDaily.com, RacismDaily.com, RacismDaily.com.
Is racism hurting you? On issues of race, are you unable to speak, think, and act with clarity and confidence? Are you tired of laughing when nothing is funny, smiling when you are not happy, agreeing when you really disagree? CounterRacism.com, you can learn specific strategies and techniques to counter the behaviors of the people who practice racism in all areas of activity. Using words correctly, following counter-racist logic, even counter-racist science projects designed to reveal what racism is, how it works, and how to counter it. The open source code writing format allows you to pick and choose from a variety of counter-racist suggestions so you can produce the code that works for you. Stop by counterracism.com today and help replace racism with justice.
That's counter-racism.com.
Do you need a one-stop shop for all of your multimedia needs? Triumphant Multimedia is a skilled team of professionals with a passion for great marketing and chic design. Our specialties include consulting, brand development, copywriting, and creative graphic design. That's second to none. We also offer photography, photo retouching, videography, and video editing. At Triumphant Multimedia, our goal is to provide highly effective creative solutions built to suit any individual need or budget. Give us a call at 678-732-8067 or check us out online at TRIMultimedia.com.
Context of White Supremacy. We will be back on Thursday. I am very much looking forward. We should have a white author on the program. She wrote the book Lynching as Spectacle. The book basically is not just about lynching, although certainly that's at the center, but it's more about these as public events and the significance of having these public executions, public acts of white terrorism, and what it meant, why it was so important that you had hordes, literally thousands of whites who come out to watch a black person or black people being butchered, mutilated, the taking of the souvenirs. What does that mean? What is the significance of that with the system of white supremacy? That's what the book is all about, and detailing the evolution of that process and how that helped solidify what it meant to be white, to come out and be a participant, even the religion of white supremacy, because a lot of times these lynchings happened and public executions happened near churches, sometimes even on church property. Has some amazing photographs. One where you can see a black male being lynched, and literally he is in the center of, like, it just looks like hundreds of white people. And I mean, they're like right up on him, like no space, like as close as we can get. We want to be there to hear and experience everything. They're right up on him as he's about to be hung. Just remarkable, but really interesting text. And as I said, when I told this white author why I wanted her on the program, the information she has in the book is great, but I think it very closely ties to what we're seeing today with all of these images, the cell phone video, dash cam video of black people being tased, choked, shot, killed, beaten, whatever it is, by enforcement officials, that I think it's very, very similar. Isabel Wilkerson, she wrote a great piece outlining and giving the same theory. We've talked about it on the program for at least 2-3 years now. I pitched that, and it seemed like she was even seeing some of the correlation between this sort of thing, being able to observe these black deaths and what that means to white people, seeing these acts being carried out. And particularly since what we're talking about is state-sanctioned violence, when it's police going out and doing this, what does that mean symbolically for whites? Very, very interesting read. Talking about having enthusiasm with learning and being able to see real-world application to what it is that you're reading, this book definitely qualifies. But that should be Thursday, normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We should have another program slipped in at some point between now and Saturday, just because with the program Thursday, and then we'll be back Friday, Medical Apartheid, second installment in our book club, and then the compensatory call-in on Saturday. That'll be 19 programs. We do one more. We'll have 20 programs. Just we've been very active for the month of April, hopefully with constructive information, but definitely we have been on our counter-racist grind for the spring of 2016. That being said, before I get, if anybody had commentary that they wanted to add in, I thought Dr. Mazama just really outstanding information. Very impressed with her presentation and really enjoyed hearing from her. Hopefully we can have her on the program again. Thanks to the listener who recommended her just based on the article that was republished that she wrote. It was republished in the Washington Post about the very topic that we discussed this evening, black parents turning to homeschooling as a result of white supremacy in the classroom. So great information. I hope folks learned a lot, took some notes. I was rethinking. People had asked about why this program is titled The Context of White Supremacy, talking about reading significant things, not just busy work or frivolous types of publications and what have you. Neil Postman, who is a suspected racist, he wrote two books. He's written several, but two books that I read very close together that had a big impact on my thinking and even why this program is titled Context of White Supremacy. I mentioned it before. One of them is Amusing Ourselves to Death. I think Dr. Mazama talked about getting rid of the television, which I think I've heard before on this program. But it talks a lot about context. Like, I went and I was looking in the book, because it talks about this move to us just being all into entertainment and distractions and nonsense and just frivolous information that doesn't really have any practical value that you can't really use in your daily life. That's one of the major points that he makes in this book, Amusing Ourselves to Death. And so I was looking back over the book like, wow, this had a big impact on my thinking, and again, why this program is called The Cows. So the term context comes up in that book like 64 times. So I'm looking over some of the different places where he's talking about context. And I thought this was really fascinating. I said, I'll share this on the program, and it seems relevant even to the discussion that we had today with Dr. Mazama. So this is from Neil Postman, Amusing Ourselves to Death, Public Discourse in the Age of Show Business. This is from Chapter 5, The Peekaboo World. So he writes, "It may be of some interest to note in this connection that the crossword puzzle became a popular form of diversion in America at just that point when the telegraph and the photograph had achieved the transformation of news from functional information to decontextualized fact. This coincidence suggests that the new technologies had turned the age-old problem of information on its head. Where people once sought information to manage the real contexts of their lives, now they had to invent context in which otherwise useless information might be put to some apparent use. The crossword puzzle is one such pseudo-context. The cocktail party is another. The radio quiz shows of the 1930s and 1940s and the modern television game show are still others. And the ultimate, perhaps, is the wildly successful Trivial Pursuit. In one form or another, each of these supplies an answer to the question, what am I to do with all these disconnected facts? And in one form or another, the answer is the same. Why not use them for diversion, for entertainment? To amuse yourself in a game. In The Image, Borstein calls the major creation of the graphic revolution the pseudo-event, by which he means an event specifically staged to be reported, like the press conference, say. I mean to suggest here that a more significant legacy of the telegraph and the photograph may be the pseudo-context. A pseudo-context is a structure invented to give fragmented and irrelevant information a seeming use. But the use the pseudo-context provides is not action or problem-solving or change. It is the only use left for information with no genuine connection to our lives. And that, of course, is to amuse. The pseudo-context is the last refuge, so to say, of a culture overwhelmed by irrelevance, incoherence, and impotence." I will stop there. Fascinating paragraph. This is a fascinating book. Even it's been a while since I've read this book. I think it's been probably 10 years since I've read the whole book. But wow, when I went back and reread it, this book might need to adjust my top 10 a tad because it's really, really important. Again, I'm not sure this program would be called The Context of White Supremacy if I had not read this book. In fact, I can even put a timeline on it. I read this book roughly 6 months, 6 to 7 months before The Cows came into existence in 2007, but just roughly 6 months. He also wrote Stupid Talk, Crazy Talk, which is another great book that's all about words, language, how incorrect use of words produces a lot of confusion and conflict. Another great book, but this one in particular, I was even thinking maybe we should do this for the book club at some point because it is a great, great book. And I mean, wow, the system of white supremacy does a phenomenal job keeping non-white people, in particular black people, keeping us in a realm of pseudo-context that is disconnected from the system of white supremacy. So we are just deluged drowned, suffocated with irrelevant, incoherent, and impotent, can't even really call it information, just misinformation and details that have no practical use about problem solving, change, improving our lives, just nonsense, total and utter nonsense, primarily that is going to be used to keep us distracted and amused while white people continue to pulverize us. But great section that I thought I would share on the broadcast. Anywho, folks have it, or I guess even before I get, if folks have anything they would like to share, I would say once again, the term non-white, I thought she gave very logical explanation of her feelings about the term non-white and it not being used, which has been presented before on the program. Jane Elliott, admitted white supremacist, she was on the program in 2010. She almost said pretty close to repeating verbatim what you heard from Dr. Mazama in terms of its centers. Whiteness, it puts them at the focal point of everything as though they are the standard. They are the norm by which everything else is to be judged and judged as inferior and defective in this system. And I only submit the same thing that I told Jane Elliott in 2010 is the same reason why I continue to use the term non-white, because that is, unfortunately, the reality, the world that we live in under the system of white supremacy, where racists, whites, have put themselves at the center of everything by which everybody else should be judged as defective and inferior. And most importantly, I've concluded, and I think Dr. Mazama, we had agreement there, that very many people are in denial about this. They're in some sort of pseudo context where we're not being honest, we're not being truthful about the problem, what is at the center of all of the stress and strife and chaos that black people are facing, not just in the classroom, but in all areas of people activity. It's whites. It's racism. That is what's at the center, and that should be kept at the focal point. That's another reason why I use it. I think even in the book, The Heart of Whiteness, by one of our guests, Dr. Robert Jensen, he talks about this at the very beginning of the book and saying that, in his view, the term non-white is more accurate than the term people of color, because there is no such thing as a group. There is nothing that would connect all of the individuals on the planet who are classified as not white. If there was no system of racism, white supremacy, that would not constitute a group. The only thing that makes this a group is that they are classified as non-white people to be mistreated in a system of white supremacy, and that the same logic that I employ using that term, it keeps the focus, the attention on the problem, whites. And he uses that sentence in the book too. The problem is white people. Just making sure we're constantly keeping at the focus. This is the problem. This is what is producing all of the chaos that we're trying to eradicate. Whites, whites, whites. Keep them at the center of everything, because everything seems to do a great job of somehow moving them to the side where we're not really focused on this is what we need to be trying to neutralize. These are the people that are the cause of all of this. With that, folks have any comments they would like to share, what they heard from Dr. Mazama, thoughts, suggestions, things that stood out, feel free to share. If you dialed in and had a hand up, your line should be open.
Hi, Mr. Renegade, can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am. Gus is fine. You don't have to do Mr. Renegade, but yes, ma'am, we can hear you.
Okay, sir. I obviously dialed in really late, but the little bit of information that I did hear from Dr. Mazama was, I thought that was incredibly constructive, absolutely, and I'll certainly be listening to the archive. I'm glad she was able to come on, and it sounds like for the totality of the show that she had some fantastic information to share. So I'm just glad she was on. I'm so thankful that you were able to get her onto the show, and I just want to give thanks. That's about it.
Oh, right on, Ashe. Ditto on everything she did. She gave great information for the full time that she was here, and I, too, was really impressed with her presentation from beginning to end. Just phenomenal information.
Cool.
Other folks have commentary they wanted to make sure they got in?
Yeah, Barry.
Yes, sir.
Yes, thank you for your information, because I was wondering, I didn't hear clearly on what she stopped me about in conversation. I'm hearing the echo. Is that me?
I did hear it, but I don't hear it anymore.
Oh, yeah.
But like you said, that I've heard that before on the same program that you were referencing to. And as how you explained, I have a tendency of keeping it not necessarily to my liking ego-wise, and just deal with the system of racism and white supremacy in the most clearest, uncomplimentary way. So that has something to do with it. But I wasn't going to waste that kind of time in the because it was kind of off subject on what the program was about, and also what the doctor was being questioned on. So I kind of like just, you know, left it alone as far as that concerned. You know, I mean, what's the statement, VGQ? You know, as far as that concerned, and keep it moving in a constructive way. But yes, I agree. She really had some very valuable information. On one hand, as a educational employee, I know that she is very busy, but at the same time, she puts the practice of teaching right with the people who are most close to her, which is highly commendable, in my opinion, when someone is actually practicing that on a daily basis. And how many children? She said three. Uh-oh, I can't hear anybody.
Two.
I can hear him. I don't know if Gus is off the line.
Hello? Gus is right here.
Oh, okay. I was wondering if I was being heard. That's all. I was mentioning about how commendable it was that, you know, as a college professor / teacher, and then she also at the same time homeschools her own children. That's logic in big bold letters, you know, as far as that concerned, in my opinion. You know, I'm almost wondering how in that situation she actually had the time to be able to do it, you know. But I'm very grateful to be able to hear someone who is actually doing that. And so it was a good show, good program.
Mm-hmm. I think she shared too about the time concerns, about saying, just being honest, saying that, you know, homeschooling, she didn't want to make it seem like it's the easiest thing to do, that it can be very challenging, that obviously she has a full itinerary being a professor, and not just being a professor. She's managing editor of a journal for Black publications.
Wow.
And she does a lot. She seems like she has a lot going on, and traveling a lot, taking her child to Cuba with her and that sort of thing. But she said, you know, at times it would be, these are your assignments, and I'm, you know, not going to be able to this week to sit on top of you and do everything and make sure you're doing this. These are your assignments, and I'll check in on Friday to see that you've done the work. That, you know, sometimes that's what it is. So I think just being truthful about that, and I think that's important, because I think sometimes people frequently, I even ask that question on the program, that you have a lot of single parents, and or even if you have a two-parent home where they both work full-time jobs. They both might work, you know, 40-plus hours a week under the system of racism. Whites do a great job of just totally stealing our time and energy, so that some people might feel that it's really challenging, and they might not have the academic background that she has, where she's had all this, you know, fantastic schooling, where they just don't feel that they are as equipped to adequately teach their child. And I thought she gave some great responses on that as well, about just making the effort to make the time, and networking with other Black parents, even if it's a small number, if it's 2, 3, 4, where you all can kind of coordinate things and take turns and that sort of thing, share resources to make it a little bit easier, so it's not as much of a burden on one person or even two people. But I thought she gave some really practical information. And everything just grounded in logic. Hey, you don't want to make the time to do it? No problem. Racists will make time for your child.
Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure there's no day that between her and her significant other / husband that there's no day that we ain't gonna do that we're gonna say we're not gonna do anything on. That's for sure. In order to get something like that done, so it's really like a confidence builder for others who are thinking about doing something like that. My question was basically from the standpoint of where my offspring is at, which is the college level. And that's where my question was coming from as far as, and it has something to do with the reference from Nathan McCall's book, Make Me Want to Holler, which I thought was a very good book years ago that he put out on historical black colleges.
If I thought that was important too, VGQ not getting bogged down, because there's no
right
victim of racism on the planet where I agree with everything that they say. It's not something where you have to pretend that you agree, because I put, when she first said something about non-white, I told her that I had a different opinion on that, and she gave her response, and it's not anything I would stop and gripe with someone about, particularly if they have other
right
information that's solid, that's constructive. I think that's really important too. Just victims guarantee qualified. She has her
right
view. I have her view. We're all working to try to solve this problem, and you don't expect consensus. It's not about looking for agreement with other black people. That is, not
right
really going to help solve anything to begin with. You're just trying to look for information that you can use, things that are logical, and keep it moving. But I think that's important, too.
Yeah, what was key also, she didn't ask me a question. So.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, sometimes people make the mistake of attempting to answer a statement. She just asked, she didn't ask me a question. She made a statement based on what she thought her thoughts was. And all of us are entitled to that. All knowing people are entitled to what their thoughts are on such matter.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Other folks have comments they wanted to get in, observations.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes. The question didn't come to me, of course, until after she got off the phone. But I was wondering how do people, or some of you can answer, go about teaching slavery and the causes? I know that there's always seems to be like a split where people say, okay, you were enslaved simply because you're the opposite, basically you're black, and the popular one is it was because of capitalism, and I wouldn't know how to approach that, or even seriously, which one is the right answer, because both have valid points.
I have an answer for that, and I have a few observations, but my answer is I always start with the Catholic Church. It was commissioned by the Pope to be able for white people, in particular the Spanish and the Portuguese, to go into Western Africa and be able to enslave people who were not Christians. They were heathens. And so I always start with the Pope. I forget his name. I think it was Alexander the First. It might have been. I might be wrong. But I know he signed something too that went with the slavery or with the war with the black people who were formerly in charge of Europe at the time.
Did the caller say, made the statement, the question to teach about slavery?
Yes, sir.
Okay, I'm trying to get it in my and process it in my head to as far as specifically.
Well, the main thing is basically the approach, because in terms of do you come at it from, okay, it was because of money, you know, capitalism, or, you know, because it was of racism, and then starting institutes of racism, or did they start racism for capitalistic, you know, capitalistic means, excuse. And so that's one of the issues I struggle with when people ask why, particularly children.
Oh, well, what I would do if you are requesting this information for your abilities to affect someone, probably the first thing I would do is read Dr. Francis Quessis Welsing's book, The ISIS Papers, because one of her major importance that she had on this planet was that she attempted, and I think successfully, attempted to answer the question on why. Mm-hmm. And basically she spoke about white people's fear of being genetically wiped out. They have a double whammy combination. They are, although they imply that they are not a minority, they are actually the not minority within the known universe. Very small numbers, and at the same time, from a biological standpoint, they are genetically inferior to any and everybody that to them is identified as not being white. And when you start applying that type of lessons to another person, it can make logical sense to them. If you, you know, take your time and be able to explain that process. And basically the explanation can become clear into the person that you're talking to in their head, as far as, you know, because that is an important, very important question that she, in my opinion, like I said before, successfully answered on why there is a global system of racism, white supremacy. And therefore, to go back to your original statement, that actually is the focal point on why people are enslaved, quote unquote, is because of the system of white racism, white supremacy. That's the byproduct on us, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense to you? Because I may not have.
No. It does. It's just that I would approach
my reference, because, you know, if I'm gonna say something, it should make sense. Is what I'm saying.
Yeah, no. It does. It's just that I mean, in terms of the theory, I would approach it as a theory, not as necessarily fact. I guess, I mean, like, would you add capitalism to that? Like, another theory is capitalism.
Those are just some of the tools that they utilize in order to have established, expanded, and maintained. Those are just some of the tools. Capitalism, direct violence. You know. That's what. But I'm talking about. I'm talking about the exact base.
Uh-huh.
Of what enslaves people. It's the global system of racism and white supremacy. No question about it, as far as what I think. And then again, you know what I mean? I heard you mention the word theory. As far as they're concerned, because the system of racism and white supremacy is still here, as of whatever the day is and time, just about everything we're saying is, you know, it's not necessarily, especially what I'm saying, is not proven out as being correct. But logic tells me that's the correct understanding.
Gotcha.
Just with that capitalism thing, because that comes up not just in reference to slavery, but that comes up
as an excuse. I would say as a convenient piece of deception to explain racist conduct, not just with slavery, but with all kinds of things, whether it's mass incarceration or a lot of different things that whites do, racists do on this planet, that it's just, it's capitalism or it's greed, or they'll come up with a lot of other things, something other than racism, white supremacy. So you can even give them that pattern, because that's going to come up a lot. They're going to hear that even now, 2016, for things that are happening where people will say, oh, it's capitalism. That's what it is. It's not white people practicing racism. It's just capitalism, or it's greed. You know, everybody just wants to make money. You know, everybody just wants to get as much as they have, or have as many resources as they possibly can. It's not white people practicing white supremacy and terrorizing individuals they classify as not white. And I know specifically with slavery, I would just point out that you had what they call white indentured servants who were not treated the same as black people, who were not treated the same as the quote-unquote red people. Just, you could even take some of the text, some of the documents where they might be saying that they think it's something other than white supremacy, and just say, well, let's just look at the evidence. Let's just look at how people were treated on the basis of their racial classification, on the basis of their skin color, and see what makes sense, and ask them to use their brain computer, as Dr. Welsing would say. Let's see what makes sense as we investigate this.
No, good point. That makes sense.
And even looking at some of the laws, because that's important too. I'm just going to say really quick, because we've done some programs, we've had white people who talked about the slavery aspect and its inception and evolution. They have pointed out that very early on in this process, you start to see laws being put in place that are exclusively restricting the behavior of black people, putting laws in place that, and I mean, this is like in the 17th century, 1600s, putting laws in place that black people in this part of the world cannot have access to firearms. That sort of thing, to me, gives a very clear clue, because you still had indentured white servants. You didn't even have a, quote, country, the United States at that time. But just that sort of thing, to me, strong indication that this is something that is operating on the basis of skin color, not just greed, that we are making clear distinctions about how people should be treated on the basis of skin color. And this is individuals who are classified as white, whether they have that classification or not at that time, but individuals who would now or were then classified as white making decisions restricting people that are classified as black or African, non-white people, making these restrictions, making these laws on the basis of color. That sort of thing, to me, sends a very strong signal, seems to be big piece of evidence of what's happening here, that this is not about just capitalism or greed or whatever, that this seems to be about skin color, the system of white supremacy.
I'm hearing you, and the subject of capitalism has been spoken on. And I recently was consulting with Mr. Fuller, and he was talking, and he gave me three ways on how to be a capitalist. And he was basically talking about white people and non-white people, but there is some differences between the two categories. But he mentioned one. To invent and or produce something that people want or need. Now, he said that's going to be a small percentage of people that's going to be able to do that. Number two, robbing and stealing. Now, that's a big way that the system, that white people under the system of race and white supremacy has done to accomplish being a capitalist. Non-white people do it also, but it's primarily as a reaction to the system of racism, white supremacy. Number three, begging and or asking for it is the third explanation that he gave, and he challenged me to whether or not I could come up with a fourth one. Hopefully that may be some help also as far as the subject matter that he mentioned to me of how to be a capitalist.
Uh,
Did other folks, if they wanted to answer the question or if you had observations on our guest, you should comment now because we're getting lower on time.
Hey, can I be heard?
Yes, sir. The television or radio or something is pretty loud in the background. If I don't know if you can get a little bit more distance from it.
Is this better?
Slight improvement.
I'm sorry about that. Yeah, I just wanted to say I like to always go back to the origins of things. And it was called Dumb Diversus. It was signed in 1452 by Pope Nicholas V. And then 2 years later, he signed Romanus Pontifex. And those two edicts or papal bulls was what commissioned or chartered the white people, which allowed them to be able to take and enslave black people from Western Africa. I did have a few observations before the show goes off. I thought the lady was excellent because at first I wasn't agreeing with her, but as I started to listen to her and put everything in the context of white supremacy, it made perfect sense. And I just wish I had the resources to do that. To piggyback off of what you said earlier, Gus, about the police snuff films being so prevalent these days, you know, the only thing I see more than that in the news is school racism, especially on the college campuses. It seems like every week, every day, it's another story of something or some college protesting. You know, I see more marching and protesting in the 60s these days on the college campuses. And it's not just the, you know, of course, you know, the white people are with the black people these days. Well, I guess they were in the 60s, too. You know, we know that's a trick, but it's like the most prestigious colleges to the state colleges, it's all of them. And I've never seen so much of this, you know, in the news back to back, especially like this month. It's just been crazy. This week it was a lot of talk about the suspensions, and I just wanted to say, like, my mother was a school teacher for 35 years. And back in the, you know, when I was a kid, so you're talking the 80s, 90s. Awful. I mean, it was like a, you know, huge thing was, you know, you couldn't suspend the student. You know, you had to come up with a way to figure it out, you know. Unless you can really prove that the student did. I mean, it was like a no suspension rule. I think the schools might have got an X amount of money from the states for the kids being there the whole day. I don't know what it was. And also, they also would only be able to leave back 4 students per year between the 8 classes. So let's just say she's teaching the 5th grade, and there's 8 5th grade classes with 30 students in each class. That they were overcrowded, of course, in the public schools. This is in Jersey City, New Jersey. The teachers were told, you know, hey, at the end of the year, you can only leave back 4 students. So if they got 20 students failing, they have to sit down amongst each other, the 8 teachers, and figure out which 4, you know, and it pretty much went down to which ones they didn't want to see back in their classrooms. You know, some of them were so bad, we don't want them back. Let's just promote them. And, you know, it was just real. So I always had a funny look with the public school system, being that my mother was a teacher. And my last little observation, because you know, this is to go back to the Prince thing. Another death of an entertainer that never sat well with me because he died so young was Luther Vandross. And I did some research today. I sent you an article, Gus, but I did some even found some more things. To see that him and 2 rock groups, they're responsible for the artist only being held to a music contract for 7 years if that contract is deemed like beneath them now. Like, so let's just say he signed the contract with Sony, and 7 years, you know, he was a mega superstar, but he's still getting paid, you know, a little bit of money because, you know, that's the same contract he started with. And, you know, they were able to effectively win a suit 11 years later, of course, but, you know, that got them all that back pay, and 2 years later he died. So I just wanted to say I just found that very interesting, because now it's another law of rule that all the artists get to benefit from. After 7 years, they get to renegotiate. And he was responsible for that, and I just had thought that was very ironic. And I'll mute my line.
Wow. Important. Very important. Very important. Other folks have comments. They wanted to make sure they get in. You should speak now if we haven't heard from you, if you wanted to respond to the question that was posed by the listener, or if you just had observations, thoughts from what we heard from our guest, Dr. Mazama. Feel free. Everybody content? If folks are satisfied, that is cool in the gang as well. I will assume folks are all good. I know people asked about the curriculums. Dr. Kamara, he was been on the program several times. He has an independent African-centered school down in Louisiana. I think he said on the program, and I think I've even seen it, shared it, I think they do have their curriculums available online that you can download. I think some of the information is free. I can put the link up to the site, which I think I've done before, but I could do it again if folks are interested in looking at some of the material, because they give out recommendations for materials, books, different resources that can be a benefit both to black children and for black parents that might be looking at homeschooling and teaching their own children. I think they have a lot of resources available, so I can share the link to his page as well. He's been on the program and talking about this subject before also, if folks are interested. Again, we should be here on Thursday. Looking forward to the content, Lynching as Spectacle. Very interesting book, which I think one of our listeners recommended some years back. I was going through my Facebook timeline. I was trying to find an article from the Seattle Times that I'd lost, and in the process of finding it, I found this book that they were talking about. This is from like 2011 that they were saying had all this great information, and I went, checked it out, started reading it, and it is pretty constructive. So I'll be looking forward. It's always great to have white people on the program. Be prepared if you have questions, thoughts. I think she did an interview on Book TV talking about this text. I'll post that if folks want to do any preparation for her visit on Thursday, but should be normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific this Thursday, context of white supremacy. If you have questions, gripes, complaints, can't find something in the archives, just feel free, drop an email, and we will try to help out untiljustice@gmail.com. Untiljustice@gmail.com. Thanks again. Suggestions, try to knock them out as we are able. With that, invest if you think the program is constructive. Racism-notes.blogspot.com. Racism-notes.blogspot.com. Listener-supported counter-racist radio. PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you're not into PayPal, drop me an email. We'll get you a physical mailing address. Huge thanks to all the folks who have invested and kept us on air for 7+ years. I hope it has been a constructive investment of your time and energy. With that, sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. Say that all the time. Hopefully it is getting through. Certainly if you're going to be out and about, particularly if you're going to be in a vehicle, you do not want to be under the influence. That's whether you're a driver, passenger, pedestrian, race soldiers. They are looking to terrorize black people for any reason at any time. You never know when it will be your day to be pulled over by Darren Wilson Daniel Holtzclaw, any of these other race soldiers. Let's do everything we can to minimize contact with them to begin with. And then let's not make their job easier by making sure we are not intoxicated. We are sober so we can make phenomenal decisions to keep ourselves as safe as possible and anybody that we might be responsible for. But again, you are just making racist job way easier if you are under the influence of any substances. Always justify killing a black person, especially so if, oh, just another drunk, drugged nigger. Of course, we had to kill him and shoot him 40 times. Buckle up. Let's do everything we can to minimize contact with race soldiers. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.